when it's some initial cursory response. It's not binding on national treasury. They need to apply their mind, their collective mind, not everybody's here from their team, and they will give a final response in about 3 or 4 weeks from now. But the initial tentative responses, they will just give some sort of signal off. Okay, over to you.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Osman Molaji. I'm the Gauteng head of PwC's International Tax Services, and I'm joined today by my colleague on the left, Kyle Mandy. He's our National Head of Tax Technical. He'll be doing most of the talking today. And behind us also Mr. Charles DeVette. He's our Africa Head and National Head for Indirect Tax, and he's going to be talking a little bit about VAT as well. I just wanted to, just before we start, just to remind my students that everything that happens here today is examinable at the end of the year.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. There are a number of issues we want to go through. We've got them up on there quickly, and so I'm not going to, in the interest of time, I'm not going to run through that. I want to jump straight into it. Just first of all, though, just in relation to the bill in general, from a volume perspective, it's in some respects it's encouraging that it's far the volume is far less than it has been in recent years. In fact, it's less than half the volume that it has than it was last year. And in some respects, that's a good thing. But in other respects, this bill is less about what was in it and more about what was not in it. And we'll come to some of those issues in a little bit later in our presentation. But just to start with, there are a few issues that are welcomed, although there was not a lot of significant substance in this year's bill. But just in that respect, the tax-free investment proposals as a general principle, those are welcomed. The reform in relation to the interest limitation, interest deduction limitations is also welcomed, although we do still have some reservations around that, and my colleague Osman will talk about that in a little while later. The developments in relation to research and development are welcomed as well as the principle insofar as transfer pricing and the secondary adjustments proposals are concerned, although we still have some significant concerns around that too, which we'll talk about a little later as well. To touch off on the tax-free investment accounts, I know that you heard some of this yesterday already from the likes of Barsa, so I will try to keep it relatively brief. One of the problems in this year's legislation in a number of respects was the quality of the drafting, which was not up to the standard it should have been, and it comes through in this item in particular as well as in some of the other items. To just give you an illustration, the definition of what is a tax-free investment for purposes of this is so broadly written that it would actually mean that, for example, every single bank account is a tax-free investment. Take that to another extreme, every single unit trust would be a tax-free investment. It just talks about the quality of the drafting and the significant work that now needs to be done to correct that and limit it to what it should be. The explanatory memorandum also talks about regulations, yet the legislation itself makes absolutely no provision for regulations to be issued. So there's significant work that needs to be done in that respect. Then in relation to the issues that you did hear about yesterday that I'm aware of, I was not. I picked it up from the press. The annual contribution limits, we support the principle that was expressed by Barsa yesterday, that those contribution limits are too low and should be increased. At the end of the day, we need to be promoting savings in this country and using every endeavour. We've got an abysmal savings level in general and an absolutely terrible household the savings level, which is in fact in a net negative position. So that's we need to be doing more or as much as possible in order to advance savings. And for that reason, we're suggesting that the limits should be increased. In relation to the penalties, we're concerned with the 40% penalty for excessive contributions. While we do support a penalty in principle, we don't believe that the 40% is the appropriate mechanism. Perhaps something around along the lines of a 10% penalty on excess contributions on an annual basis should be considered in order to give those persons have exceeded the limits and opportunity to rectify that, if you like, in subsequent years without this extreme 40% penalty applied. I hand over to Osmond to deal with the next topic.
Okay. The PwC submission on Section 23M is for that it be withdrawn in its entirety. Just a quick background. Section 23M is a provision that wants to restrict the deduction of interest using a formula. And I just by way of background, I want to make a couple of points. First of all, this proposal is presented against the backdrop of base erosion and profit shifting, and there are three important points that I want to make about that. There's a lot of hype about BEPS, base erosion and profit shifting, but point number one that keeps getting ignored is that the empirical evidence here and abroad does not support this almost panicked response to this concept of BEPS. And even if we ignore that, a secondary point that I do want to stress is that most of the solutions being proposed by the OECD come from a US Eurocentric kind of perspective. This is Africa. It's not necessarily appropriate for South Africa and Africa. In addition to that, the solutions being proposed by the OECD are not even in their final stage. They have timelines running till the end of 2015 before they're going to be publishing their reports on what their proposals are. But having said that, even if we ignore where the OECD is at present, South Africa has traditionally, for at least the last decade, been, you know, ahead of the curve in any event. So we've got sophisticated legislation that many of the developed economies are only catching up with now. And the final point I want to make on this particular slide, and this is particularly worrying about Section 23M, is that one of the warnings that the OECD does give is that it warns us against unilateral action that results in double taxation. Excellent. Proposing measures in South Africa that will limit deductions that has no regard for whether the interest is being fully taxable on the other side, again, is a specific warning from the OECD. And then as to the specifics of the way Section 23 operates or is proposed to operate in South Africa, the two big points that I want to make is, what is Section 23M targeting that is not already being targeted? We have sophisticated legislation in SA already that targets this type of abuse already. So let me be clear. I am not saying that the abuse of excessive interest deductions is not something that SARS should target. I'm saying it is. But all I'm saying is we already have it, and it's sophisticated, and it does the job. What on earth are we trying to do with Section 23M in addition? All that we see is substantial additional compliance for both taxpayers and SARS with not a huge amount of additional revenue. And in fact, if it is retained in its current form, and this is my last point, is that all it does is it extends this concept to unintended targets. So you will have, let's call them non-abusers, ordinary compliant taxpayers who shouldn't be caught in principle by these kind of provisions, who will now be caught. And I just want to list two examples. So for example, where an organization is in need of funding and they get funding from an unrelated third party, ordinarily that should be fine. But because the unrelated third party wants as security and equity, suddenly that transaction becomes tainted. Because the financier said, in order for me to give you this money, I want to take up an equity interest, suddenly the transaction is tainted. And I can't see how that could have been intended. Similarly, the concept of guarantees is so broad, meaning that, again, the point that there are going to be a lot of unintended financing transactions that should not have been caught, they will be caught. So just to close up, our submission is that 23M should be withdrawn in its entirety.
Thank you. Next item is in terms of long-term insurers, and just a reminder to the committee what the proposal is there. In essence, it is that all risk business should be taxed within the corporate fund, or within the company fund itself, so as opposed to within the policyholder funds. And we support that principle. The trouble with this proposal is that we get the sense that it's been rushed through. There's been limited consultation that's taken place. The changes are significant. In essence, what our suggestion is that a comprehensive consultation process is required on this, and it should be done over a two-year timeline. Notwithstanding that the legislation's effective date is only proposed to come to 2016, our suggestion is that it should not be in the bill this year. It should be postponed. It should come in next year following this consultation process. There are some very significant difficulties, which I won't go into the detail of right now. In relation to small business corporations, perhaps in some senses what I'm going to say now is going to be fairly controversial, but so be it. I think it needs to be said. As a general proposition, we support the withdrawal of the progressive tax rates for small businesses. That principle is supported by the likes of the OECD and the IMF as well, and the bottom line is that small businesses should not be enjoying preferential tax rates for various reasons. However, the proposal around the compliance rebate is of much greater concern, and we are opposed to that for a few reasons, the most important of which, though, is the precedent that this creates. Taxpayers should not be provided with a carrot to comply with their legal obligations. That's the first issue. So that's creating a terrible precedent by suggesting that any taxpayer should be given an incentive to comply with the law. The second issue talks to the principles of neutrality and fairness. The proposals as they are would apply only to small business companies. Now, that's a very narrow part or form of business, if you like, or form of taxpayer. It only applies to certain companies. The question that arises, well, what about sole proprietors? What about partners of partnerships? What about individual employees earning remuneration? Why should they not also be compensated for the cost of complying with the tax laws if this is going to go through? It's a very real problem. The other issue is that the proposals that have been put in place here have been cherry-picked from the Davis Committee proposals. The Davis Committee proposals came as a package. There was a whole range of issues that had to be addressed. And that included, for example, increasing the turnover limit for small business companies from the current 20 million rand to 50 million rand. It also talked about relaxing the shareholdings both in small business companies and shareholdings held by small business companies in order to broaden the scope of these things. So the trouble is that with cherry-picking just certain aspects of the Davis Committee proposals, it's watering down the proposals very, very significantly. Okay, so we have some major concerns with this proposal in that respect. In relation to the transfer pricing issues and the secondary adjustments in particular, as I mentioned earlier, we support the principle that the secondary adjustments that currently apply in the context of a deemed loan on any transfer pricing adjustment should be replaced with the deemed dividend concept. The trouble is that the way in which it has been drafted completely oversimplifies the issue. It now deems any transfer pricing adjustment to be a deemed dividend, and it fails to take into consideration a number of issues. For example, you can't have a deemed dividend applying in a situation where the taxpayer in question is not a company. It makes no sense whatsoever. Similarly, how can you have deemed dividend applying in the context of non-residents? Non-residents are not subject to dividends tax as a general proposition, so the principle should not apply to them. The other issues relate to the question that under what circumstances should a deemed dividend apply. Now, for example, it should really only apply where the dividends tax base is being eroded as a result of the transfer pricing that has taken place. So that would not apply in the situation, for example, where a resident company grants a benefit to a 100% owned subsidiary. In those circumstances, there has been no erosion of the dividends tax base whatsoever. Okay. And there are a number of other difficulties that arise with the drafting. So to whom is this deemed dividend deemed to have been declared, which is extremely important from a, from the point of view of treaty relief, or exemptions from dividends tax. When is the deemed dividend, or when does the deemed dividend arise, which is also important from the point of view, because that, at what point is your liability for dividends tax triggered? None of that is addressed currently. So our real submission here is that while we support the change in principle, there's significant development needs to be take place in this regard, and the proposals need to be reconsidered in order to address these issues, amongst others. In relation to retirement savings, to a large extent, this is not incorporated in the current bill, but I've included this for the reason that there is essentially a carryover from last year's legislation. Significant submissions were made last year in relation to the monetary cap of 350,000 Rand, which were opposing that monetary cap. I'm not going to go into the full detail of it again, but essentially it was because of the effect it would have on savings. At worst, it would mean that there would be no savings in excess of those monetary caps. At best, it would mean that savings would be significantly reduced and would be saved outside of the retirement fund system. This committee admitted last year that this issue would need to be reconsidered this year. Unfortunately, this is not something that has been reconsidered at this point, and we'd like to put it on the table that it should be revisited, and that, in our view, that monetary cap should be withdrawn in its entirety, or at the very least, should be significantly raised. And hand over to Osmond to deal with.
Okay, I'll be very quick, because Charles wants to say something on VAT as well. And this is one single point: the proposed withholding tax on services fees. It was suggested last year, and the proposal was that it would be revisited. Our point remains the same as it was last year: that this is another proposal that creates a brand new tax, which generates hardly any revenue, but creates a huge amount of additional compliance burden for taxpayers and for SARS. If this is a reporting requirement, we can have reporting mechanisms in place without creating an entirely new tax. Charles.
Now it's on. Apologies for that. I wanted to talk to the proposed amendment on the zero rating of farming inputs that we are very concerned about. I mean, while from a tax purist view, one would want to limit the exceptions in the Act, I mean, both in respect of, you know, sort of zero rating and exemptions, this was a policy that was introduced in 1991 and has served the sector well as far as that's concerned. Agriculture in a slightly different perspective, is treated slightly different because a lot of their sales are zero-rated in respect of fresh fruit and vegetables, so they don't collect VAT on the sales side of things. So I think that needs to be taken into account. So an amendment that is this significant, it's important to understand the effect on the supply chain. We think that it goes to food security, both in terms of quality and in respect of yield of the particular product, and we understand that the basis for it is as a result of significant fraud. We think that the fraud should be addressed specifically by compliance, and that there are practical solutions that will not significantly increase the compliance cost, both for SARS and for vendors in this particular space. So we would ask that the amendment is scrapped at this particular point in time, and if that's not possible, that it's at least delayed until there's been more work done in this particular space to get to a reasonable answer for the economy and for the sector.
Carl? Yeah. So, Chairman, I know we're pretty much out of time, so I will wrap up very quickly for you. As I mentioned earlier, there are a number of issues that have not been addressed in the bill. I'm not going to go through them now, in our view, these issues still need to be addressed. They are creating very significant uncertainties. On the tax administration side, I'm not going to go through these things in any detail at all, but there are a number of issues that we're concerned with in relation to the proposals, particularly around reportable arrangements and the tax compliance status. But, Chair, I know we're out of time, and we will discuss those issues as well.
Look, we do have one or two members of the committee who are quite conversant with tax issues. You'd be relieved to know, and I, as the particularly relieved about. But we also have the Parliamentary Budget Office that's operational. Mr. Musani and Chonde, we have some work done on 23M. It keeps coming up, okay? So they're assisting us as well. So, you know, there's overlap to some, well, to a significant extent, between what you say and at least some of the other parties say. So we're organizing all those, and yesterday there's a proposal that we have a workshop with Treasury, a closed workshop to discuss these issues. But now I'm told we're discussing in half 5 minutes to 1 minute to close, because we can't find a slot. So the committee with you guys are at APEC. We're going to decide whether we can do that or not. We did, by the way, get an apology from Sandy and from Bear. They were held up in traffic. Obviously, that traffic flow didn't affect the rest of us because we've got our private plane. Sandy and I have discussed this outside this meeting. Sandy's welcome. Sandy DeVries, really valued member of our committee. Right, over then to the next input. Are we taking you the time and then there's questions? All mutual, please. 20 minutes, but it's not 15 because women are keen to engage. While they're getting together, I must tell you, I bumped into a member this morning about this. He says to me, hey, where are we meeting? So I explained to the person. Then a person rightly says, I hope Alan and Peter follow me. Why do you keep changing? She's right. How does it have a standard committee room for each committee? If we have 35 committees, the S12 is out and that's it. And it says, by the way, the member concerns, which I shall not mention, it starts though with M and the surname starts with a K. It's very, very vertically challenged. I must tell you, she's right, actually. We should have a standard one. Yeah. Alan says they've been fighting for that. Yeah? What's the DA policy on the matter?
Our view is we agree with you on this one. In 2008, when I served on finance, we met all the time in E249, and it worked extremely well. And then there was something about why we needed to move around. But I do think we should make a stand on it, because it is crazy moving around like we do. Thanks, Chair. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. My name's Christine. I'll do the introduction. Nombo, who works with me in the Development Impact Fund, will do the technical part. Kazi, who's in the Old Mutual Tax Office, will do a rounding up of the issues. Who, me? Why, do you mean because there's three of us? As a smart.
We're very close to
you, Michelle.
We're very close.
It's easier to do the presentation.
Yeah.
That's true. Just to give you an idea of what we do, we're particularly wanting to address 23M. Next slide. We, Nombo and myself, are involved with what is called the Development Impact Fund. We manage three funds. They aimed largely at the FSE charter income level. We do schools, investment into independent schools, low-fee paying independent schools. It's low-income housing and it's small business development, largely. We have, they're significant funds. It's about $15 billion, which is under management. We do significant size investments. Our average size is around $400 million, though the smallest is about $80 million and the biggest is about $1 billion. We deal with counterparties. We invest in counterparties who are almost by definition unlisted, small to medium-sized companies who are not necessarily have the corporate governance and the sort of institutional depth to manage the amount of investment that we're often doing. We're attempting to be hugely catalytic, and so indirectly we're having a business development impact, or we attempt to have a business development impact. How do we do it? We invest using special purpose vehicles, project specific, they're terminating, they have no operating function within the SPV at all. They terminate when the last house has been built or the loans have been paid off for the school, etc. They're always ring-fenced, so we attempt to separate from the actual operating company for our security. To mitigate the risks, we always take a minimum of 50%. Normally not more than 50%, but 50%. If we can get a cession of the shares of the rest of the company, we do so. Our funds are out for a 10 to 15 year period, a very long period of time. During that term, we find our counterparties often go through management problems or, you know, other problems where we need to step in, support, sometimes replace the manager and put another manager in place. So for us, a material part of our security is in fact the cession of shares and the stake we take in the SPV. We don't take a stake in the operating company at all. So we're only interested in where our investment is, which is in the SPV. If you look at whose money we manage in terms of these development impact funds, they're mostly tax-exempt pension funds. So it's Old Mutual Life Assurance Company, it's the Government Employees Pension Fund, it's Eskom Pension Fund, and it is another tax-exempt body, namely the Development Bank of South Africa. So we exclusively are dealing with pension funds or tax-exempt bodies entirely. Our normal security, which we take when we do these investments into the SPV, is we take physical security insofar as we can get it. That is, we take mortgages over the raw land and the developments that happen on that land, and we take a mortgage over the school. Clearly, in terms of school buildings, the mortgage is not of huge value because it's such a purpose-specific building. So it's not easy to sell it out in the open market and recover your security. Our operating security, in terms of making sure that the school delivers, that we can step in or the developer delivers, is the cession of shares, as I've said. It's the cession of the SPV bank account, the subordination of the junior levels of debt, and it's ring-fencing the SPV and isolating or alienating the operating company from the ring-fenced SPV insofar as we possibly can. Only 23M, nothing else. Yes. The next two slides should show you. Okay, Noms picks that up.
All right. In terms of our typical structure, what we have are the investment fund, which we have the investment fund, the partner or the operating entity with which we partner with, and then the terminating project SPV, which Christine alluded to earlier on. In terms of our investments, we have the debt investments as well as our 50% or minimum of 50% share in the equity, again, as Christine alluded to earlier on. As an example of the impact of 23M, we're basically going to talk to one of our investments, Barsa Schools. By way of background, Barsa is the Barsa Educational Institute Trust. is an organization that basically provides low-fee schooling to previously disadvantaged communities. They currently run about five schools in Diepsloot, in the Joburg inner city as well as Soweto. In terms of that particular structure, as Christine mentioned earlier, we have the schools fund, of which the investors are Old Mutual, the GEPF, whose funds are managed by the PIC. In terms of the actual impact of 23M, we've highlighted over here that we basically, through our 100% equity, we have a controlling relationship with our SPV, and therein lies the impact of 23M. Now, back in terms of background, we have a dual mandate in terms of having a commercial return to our investors, who are typically members of pension funds and policyholders, and we also have a social impact mandate. We, in this instance, provide affordable education. Now, the impact of 23M on the SPV is around a significant increase in the tax expense, which would then lead to lowering of profits and ultimately lower investment returns for our investors. Now, the options available to us are twofold. The first one being increase the school fees to be able to deliver a minimum return to our investors and thereby meeting our threshold in investor returns. Now, the consequence of that is obviously education may no longer be affordable to the communities that we're trying to target. In other words, we don't achieve our social mandate. We're therefore moving our target market more upmarket. Our second option is we basically do nothing. In other words, investors receive a lower investment return. The consequence then for them is we don't actually achieve the investment return, and thereby this type of development investment is no longer attractive for future investors, and thereby significant development funds will decline. And there basically is the conclusion of our presentation. I'll leave it up to Kazi to summarize.
As one can see from our presentation, Section 23M has far more reaching unintended consequences. So our request reiterates of that of PwC is we request for Section 23M to be scrapped in its entirety, or as a second prize, the threshold that is currently applied to determine control for purposes of this section refers to the connected person definition. So we're actually requesting for that threshold to increase to 70%. So one would actually use the group test construct. As a third prize, if the two are not working, we're requesting for further consultation. So that would require deferral of the section, the application of the section.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mohammed Jada. I'm from KPMG. We've submitted the detailed comment. I think the purpose of this presentation is just to go over some policy direction, and that's it. And I'll try to be as brief as possible. Alan, how do you move this? Oh, there we go. Okay. That's the agenda. I'll quickly run through that. Just to look at where South Africa stands with regard to research and development, and look at some issues that we've picked up in administering it. Okay, as you can see on this slide, various countries around the world offer research and development tax incentives, and the purpose of this is to really attract more high-value, high-end type of technology investment. In a nutshell, it makes the country and the productive economy much more competitive and increases the high-end skill of jobs around the country. And the reason I've set out this slide is you can have a look. There's more and more countries that we see starting to offer much more incentives for investment in research and development. Research and development is not just cement blocks and buildings. It actually is a very mobile piece of technology and mobile type of skill. So it does move around the world quite a lot. Okay. The slide that I put up there just gives you an indication of the R&D spend as a percentage of a country's GDP. South Africa's spend has been less than 1% since 2007. Details for 2010 and 2011 is not available, but at a recent meeting that was held by the Department of Science and Technology, they indicated that for 2011 it's around 0.67%. The target has always been at least 1%. And even the target of 1% is way below the average of the OECD. Now, granted, the OECD is a very advanced set of group of countries. But I think in terms of policy direction, this really needs to be taken in context of what's happening around the world. Okay. So it is concerning there's a downward trend of the level of amount of expenditure. Okay, a nice slide, the next one. My kids like the bubbles and the colors. What this really does is it shows you, relative to size and relative to GDP, where South Africa stands. South Africa is at the bottom left-hand corner, and you can see it's less than 1%. And the bigger the bubble, that means is the larger amount of scientists, engineers, technical people per million per population. So as you can see, the United States by far has a greater amount, given their population size. China's not very far behind, but if you look at countries such as India, even though they are less than 1%, relative to their GDP, that's a large amount. So our GDP is just over a trillion, and we've got less than 1%.
So that would be the yellow.
That's right. So it's quite small. Okay. Okay. And for those of you who remember Nokia, that's Finland's claim to fame in terms of the top right-hand corner. Okay, so it just shows what really can happen to a government on the technology front. Okay, so from a policy perspective, it really is, if you want to incentivize investment in research and development, you've got to do two things. One is got to stimulate the local economy, and second is you've got to attract the multinationals. Multinationals' research and development is very mobile. They'll go to the country where it offers the best bang for your buck. So if you're looking at the incentive, you're either incentivizing, you relax the rules, and you have a higher rate of benefit, and hopefully you'll be able to manage a greater increase of investment, or you'll be more protective and you tighten the rules. Now, somewhere between those two continuums is where the policy should be with my submission. And from a revenue perspective, and this is particularly from a National Treasury perspective, the compliance framework becomes quite important. If you are pushing it from a tax perspective, it is sometimes, and we've seen in practice quite often, quite jarring against what is the approach from a scientific or engineering perspective. And more we have seen that the compliance costs versus the ease of actually participating in this regime is getting to the point where it's becoming too much of a hassle for companies to actually participate, which really defeats the aim of the purpose of the incentive in the first place. Okay, I'm just subconscious of time, so I'm going to run through this. I've got three areas which I want to go through. Currently, if you want to apply for the incentive, you've got to submit a pre-approval application. If you do not submit a pre-approval application, you cannot qualify. Once the pre-approval application has been reviewed by the committee of the Department of Science and Technology and they've given you a view, that is final. If their view is your application is denied or is not acceptable, there is no recourse built into the legislation whatsoever. Unlike every other piece of tax legislation where if you're unhappy with the decision, then there is no objection and appeal process. So in the normal course, if you submit a deduction and SARS disallows it, you can actually take it on appeal or eventually go to the court to settle your view. But in terms of Section 11D, that simply doesn't exist. So for many companies, when they receive their letter saying that their project has been denied, insufficient information was given in terms of what was the reason for the applications being denied. There was a complaint from many parties that there's more than 18 months has passed since they put the application in and going back to 1 October 2012. And there's insufficient interaction in terms of the applicant and the response. So 18 months passes and you receive a letter saying your application has been declined. And the reasons are not forthcoming. It's just a one-line statement, it does not qualify. But no detailed reasons are given for that. So, and if you want to submit a new application for them to review it, the way the legislation works is you only get the incentive based on the day you put the application in. So if you have to put a new application in, everything that you spent up to the time that you put the application in, you lose that ability to claim the incentive. So we strongly believe it's contrary to the promotion of access to judicial administration. And in terms of our constitution, you know, there is a legitimate cause for asking for reasons for objection and also to have procedurally fair administrative action. And the recommendation that we have is please, from a national treasury point of view and from a legislative point of view, from a policy point of view, please do consider putting in some sort of recourse mechanism. The downside of not doing that is cases going to court. And I believe that's not the right way this should be handled. Okay, the next one is something that I term a world-beating requirement. Now, in last year's amendments, and thank you for the council, last year when we did the presentation, I think sanity prevailed, and a lot of these problematic suggestions were actually removed from the legislation. One of the terms is that in order to qualify, you actually have to be doing something that is new to the world. In other words, the development that you are looking for should have not been undertaken anywhere else in the world. What we have found is, even though that amendment was done away with last year, and rightfully so, it is still subjectively being applied by the committee members when they review the application. So the question really is, the Department of Science and Technology, the adjudication committee, sorry, not these committee members. Okay. So it really is a very high threshold to apply. We are not the most advanced economy. We have pockets of excellence, but we are not yet there. So I think from a policy direction, from a parliament point of view, we need to decide, what do we want to do? Does our research and development, our attempts to grow and our technology, have to be world-beating? I think that is a step too far. I think that probably is the right answer, but not right now. We have to have a two-phase approach. Example, countries like Singapore and Australia, their requirement is not as high. Their requirement is, as long as it's unique to that country, that is fine. And many times when you're trying to develop something, your access to intellectual property where it may have been developed somewhere else is limited. You do not have the know-how of getting there. So you still have to go through the process of researching, hopefully succeeding without many failed attempts in order to develop your technology. So this really puts our companies who are trying to invest in more research and development in South Africa at a disadvantage. And essentially, what is the incentive? The incentive is a funding mechanism, and this is done through the tax incentive. The alternative is to say that take it away from the tax incentive and rather give it as a grant, because there really is problematic dealing with the interpretation in the tax legislation. Okay, the term innovative has been inserted. It is subjective, and it's subjectively applied by the committee members. So even though the legislation has a definition of what research and development is, there is a veto vote by the committee member to override an application. And I think that's procedurally unfair. So, in summary on this point, the Parliament's policy intention really needs to be clarified and confirmed. Okay, the last point is, and this may be controversial, but I question the composition of the committee members, and again, I stress this is the committee members of the Department of Science and Technology. The committee is made up of three people from the Department of Science and Technology, one person from National Treasury, and three people from SARS. I'm not going into too much detail, but we have seen that there's a lot of angst amongst the Department of Science and Technology committee members in terms of the balance of power in that committee. In my view, the role of SARS is to administer the system and not to pronounce on eligibility. The whole reason the whole system changed in October 2012 was to give the ability to regulate what is R&D and not to the Department of Science and Technology and take it away from SARS. By having the SARS committee members on there, I believe we are watering down that intention. So the proposal is the judiciary committee should only be comprised of members from National Treasury and the Department of Science and Technology. And an example of this is the long-standing battle that finally has come to a successful outcome, or we hope a successful outcome, in terms of pharmaceutical trials. and clinical trials and research on generic products. The view from SARS has always been that development of pharmaceutical products where the critical component has been initially developed overseas and the trials have been undertaken in South Africa does not qualify as research and development. After 2 years, or almost close to 2 years, it is finally, and this is without going through, not to mention all of the legal opinions that has been obtained by the Department of Science and Technology and National Treasury, that they finally decided that they will agree that clinical trials is indeed research. Now, if we look at the long-term policy objective, if you don't encourage an incentive for clinical research, they are most likely to go somewhere else to do it. Okay, so I think really a serious discussion has to happen at a parliamentary level in terms of what is the policy direction for research and development and what do we really want to achieve from this. Okay. And the last slide is a summary. There's really an increasing competition for outsourcing R&D. I've been involved in two recent analysis cases of multinational companies. They were considering South Africa versus India. And they decided it's too much effort to do it in South Africa because of this process. They are now going to move the R&D function to India. Okay. So it's a priority for many governments, incentivizing R&D. India and Singapore implemented brand new incentives. Australia proposes a cash back for research and development, whereas here we only get a deduction at the end of the year. And the UK regime has a two-tier approach, one for small and medium entities and one for larger entities. It has been noted by the Department of Science and Technology that most companies that apply for the R&D are large companies in South Africa. The small to medium enterprise market is not really present in that. So an opportunity to actually look at a separate system for small to medium enterprises is really valid. Okay, and last, the subjective application of innovative threshold and the lack of recourse. These are key factors discouraging both SA-based companies. So, in conclusion, the policy direction really needs to be reaffirmed and to help encourage more investment. If the policy is that we are not going to incentivize R&D in South Africa, then so be it. Remove the incentive from our legislation. But the current state of affairs cannot go on. We're just going to have much more legal cases coming through, which the country can't afford. Thank you.
I apologize for the last time that I was late. Thank you, Honorable Chair. My questions will relate to the presentation by KPMG. When listening to the presentation, it's presented in such a way that suggests that compliance versus scientific research. Compliance versus scientific research. The gentleman says that there's no need for SARS in a committee that just needs National Treasury and the Department of Science and Technology. Very interesting debate. If we can get involved in a discussion that talks about intellectual property, my opinion is that intellectual property is your ability to create something different, something that is not there in the world. And I'll make an example. In South Africa, we produced the Royal Farm. But we get people who actually beat us in R&D to sell some of the parts that we produce in other countries. We have lost a lot of business when we try to sell what we are able to do. Now, you're saying that we must be able to open up to multinational companies that actually do exactly the same. They sell their intellectual property to us. You say it must be a situation where there's cash for R&D. Do you know, it means that at no point will a scientific research made by South Africans win in an environment where these well-established multinational companies bring their R&D. And I can make a lot of examples. We want to harvest a wind, the Danish will beat us. will want to harvest energy through our solar, the Germans will beat us if we take your approach. Now, one thing I want to know, and maybe at some point South will respond to this thing, but I need your suggestion. What are your suggestions in terms of the cost mechanisms, in terms of the conditions of R&D and intellectual property? It shouldn't just be a way where you say they must come with a mechanism. What are the suggestions? What do you suggest in this matter, because they relate to technological innovation? How do you think it should have been the best approach, except this one where you say SARS must stay away? It can't stay away. There are many other issues that will make them to play a particular interest. And one of the things that I'll make an example, and I'm going to make a crude example, Honorable Chair. You see, there is Ebola that came up, and very quick, there are other countries that have developed a mechanism to cure it so quick. And it's a different Ebola from the one that was there before. But they already had an intellectual property ready to cure it. And these are pharmaceutical companies that are involved in research and development. So there will be institutions that are interested, not only in compliance, many other things that involve rents and cents of a particular country. I might be wrong. There are people who are learned here who can advise us. I'm just an ordinary citizen. So let's find each other on this matter. There is a way where we can sit and say, because to me, it's not only about economic stimulation. It's about also having your intellectual property rights protected, your own innovation and technology being produced. And are we saying we lack that talent? We can't do it? And are we supposed to only concentrate on companies that can do it? In fact, we even separate the small emerging companies and want to legislate them separately? Is that the point we're making here? Of course, innovation is subjective. Innovators actually doesn't look at rents and cents. That's why they will never want an interference of people who want to look at compliance. Singers doesn't know how to administer their own voices to make money out of it. Do they? They don't. That's why most of them die as paupers. The only thing that they know is to stand in front of a microphone and sing. There are those who produce the songs on their behalf and manage the companies on their behalf and make money on their behalf. It's part of the marketing strategy. I've done something closer to that, marketing. And I know how these pharmaceutical companies market their products. I rest my case.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've just got three questions for PwC. Firstly, on the issue of the quality of the drafting, I'm just wondering whether there's been any engagement with SARS and the National Treasury on that, because if the law is opening up a space for more tax relief on savings, I don't think that actually is a problem, or shouldn't be. And then on the Davis Tax Committee, are you saying, well, we've seen that there's been some work on the small businesses, are you saying that we should wait for this entire process to finish before any amendments are made to the law? Well, certainly this committee hasn't seen any of their work yet. So I'm just wondering if that's what you're saying. And then on the retirement funds, yes, we know there is a huge problem with the capping, the monetary cap, and also the looming fringe benefits tax on employer contributions to defined benefit funds. Have you had any engagement with the National Treasury on this? Thanks.
First of all, I think I need to make a disclaimer. I am not an expert in tax issues, please. And I know because some of our colleagues have gotten into trouble for not allowing people to say things to them, and they embrace it. They are comfortable with it. Before you know it, they are in trouble. I don't want to be in trouble. Okay. Anyway, thank you very much. My question is directed to PwC. I've heard you suggesting that one of your team members suggesting that we shouldn't be providing incentives for people to comply with the law. Now, the thing is, I'm not sure if that statement is really actually made out of, is taking us out of our own context and reality in South Africa. South Africa, we are coming from a history of exclusion. People have been excluded financially. They've been excluded in a variety of ways, the majority of the people of this country. And now, if we are saying we shouldn't be providing an incentive, and yet we've seen that these incentives do work, that is why we've had so many people. Many people are now complying with our tax laws and so forth, and that is why, you know, your personal income tax is also going up. And I think it's precisely because you are saying to people, it does pay to comply. Now, I'm not sure whether that statement is self-defeating, because it got me worried, because when you started talking about when you guys started proposing that we should withdraw completely Schedule 23M, I'm worried about that. What do we do? We cannot say we have to withdraw and the reasons are that because the whole issues arise, base erosion and profit shifting and so forth, because even in Europe and so forth, they are still not able to comprehend this. In South Africa, we are dealing with a very difficult economic conditions than in Europe. In South Africa, you have a situation where your personal income tax account for 260 billion. Your company income tax accounts for about 160 billion. Yet you have the majority of people that are really trapped in poverty, and you have, in other words, you are actually having a burden, a very huge burden carried by your individuals in South Africa. And yet we know, in fact, I know for a fact that we've invested over 22 billion for one of the car manufacturing plants, but they're only providing about 30 jobs or something like that. Now, obviously, as we are investing in technology, we also have to be thinking that at the same time, given our own economic realities of this country and the disparities that are not of our own making, we cannot. I'm not subscribing to the school of thought that says let's not invest in technology because technology is not labor intensive. Otherwise, we won't be competitive. But we must have another way of counter balancing that. So I am saying I need to understand, Uti, what exactly are you suggesting here? Or should we be really be waiting until there is a... Are you really saying South Africa can't initiate a process that can probably provide the best practice to the world? Why not? Why can't we start in South Africa? Because there is a lot of tax evasionists things that are happening when it comes to these things, especially when we deal with multinational companies. Unfortunately, most of the people that are here are as well. You know, there is a lot of tax that you are not able to, you are not leveraging as much as you should in tax. So rather than doing away with everything, you should be coming up with something at least that is going to be helping us. So I wanted to get a clarity. Are you saying we should abandon completely this aspect, which is a worry to me? Thank you.
20%. Perhaps we need to ask ourselves,
whose interests are we trying to safeguard here? The interests of the citizens or is the interests of big business? It's an important question. Perhaps we need to start first answering. Be as it may, the interests of the public must rise above and the interests of individual companies must be suppressed. And South Africans who have the interests of the country at heart wherever they are found in their business endeavors, they must be guided by that principle. The presentation by Old Mutual about all the proposals that are making, with the two options that they are proposing for consideration, if they propose option one as it is, one asks the question at whose expense and whose interest is advanced here. Maybe they must first answer the question, when are they going to deregister with the security exchanges that are in Europe and in America, so that whatever that they generate as capital and profit is put at use for the benefit of South Africa. That's an important question that you, not only Old Mutual, but many other South African companies that have registered offshores with the security exchanges. It's important that they answer that question. Because soon, you'll have to account for why, in the first place, you have yet to leave our shores and register with those. But quickly coming to KPMG, about the R&Ds. The R&D models are designed to promote capital investment by lowering taxation and to incentivize companies which are interested in investing in R&Ds. The danger with the R&Ds model is that should an R&D identify elsewhere, for instance, in Harrismith in the Free State, a company which is based in a small town, maybe in Smithfield or in Bloemfontein, with the prospect of making more capital and be exempted from tax burdens and all of that, with the hope it will be incentivized if it relocates to Harrismith. What are the consequences of capital outflow from a small town to an RD town? Such implications have to be looked at, and I hope government will have regulatory measurements in place to guard against that. I hope government do have such instruments in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just with regards to the zero rating on the farming inputs, if I can just make the point, of course, the fraud that needs to be addressed by compliance, I think that's a very important issue. But what would be those mechanisms in terms of compliance that you propose? I just read up something that fraud, however, should be addressed by SARS audits and the verification and audit of the VAT 103 certificate in conjunction, and that was a proposal yesterday by the Organized Agriculture in conjunction with Organized Agriculture. It seems to me a little bit vague, and then the additional VAT 201 form for zero-rated inputs. Is there anything else that you could recommend in terms of addressing the fraud issue? Noting, of course, that the fraud issue is very significantly small compared to the annual revenue collected by SARS from the sector, which is about, I think it's 100 billion per year, and fraud only constitutes about 600 million per year. I take that, but the fraud still needs to be addressed, and perhaps your opinion with regard to that. And then also it needs to be noted on the cash flow for the many small-scale farmers who are not registered. Will they have to then pay the 14% for value-added tax? With regard to the purchase, and then if my assumption is correct, they will not be able to offset it in terms of the process again. So that, am I correct then to say that will have an increase of about 14% on their cost factor, which could be significantly devastating for the emergence of small-scale farmers? Just your opinion on that, thank you. And then just with regard to the R&D, so if I can just ask you a question. The tax incentive is is only to be offset at the end of the year in terms of your tax compliance, etc. So that also have a cash flow, a massive cash flow impact on the industry. But what other alternatives are you suggesting? And you've spoken about grants needed. Are there not any other avenues for grants? And what grants is available in terms of this R&D? And noting, of course, that we simply need to increase the R&D component in the country. Thank you so much.
Chair, I just wanted a clarity from Old Mutual. Whilst I do understand that there might be an unintended consequence as a result of 23M on SPVs, but the challenge that I have, though, is that the whole investment in education, investing in your future, to me, I mean, as an outsider, has not really worked, because I have not come across a case where somebody has been putting that money aside, and that money, number one, you have a situation where my kids went to Crawford School. So I was paying significantly less for my daughter when she was at the university than when I was paying for her when she was at Crawford. And whatever investment I made on her education was just negligible. I'm not sure if we are just blowing this thing out of proportion by making this example about BASA and say, you know, education may no longer be affordable, don't achieve social mandate, more upmarket and what have you. I mean, the reality of, I don't know what's your take on this, but my own layman, I've never conducted any empirical research on that, but if we are going to be taking the decision based on the information we're given here, it's not cutting it with me, because I think the reality of our own education system in South Africa, it's either your child is at a no-paying school, no-fee-paying school, or it is at Model C school where they are paying about 26,000, and which is actually far much more if you look at how much you spend for a three-year degree at the university and what you invest during the high schooling or whatever of your child, your high schooling and primary. So there are those three things, and I'm not sure if you are overblowing this whistle about this thing that it's the, at the end of the day, to me, it's got nothing. It has very little to do with education to me, the whole investment in education. Anyway, I might be wrong. Please do correct me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, to KPMG on the non-existence of recourse mechanism. I'm not sure, because even when you cite that other alternatives, you never cite that the Ombuds office. And I'm getting worried that it seems if some players in the industry seems not to be appreciated the existence of this important institution. I just want to know, I mean, do you see such an institution playing its role, or don't you see it playing its role in addressing this recourse problem that you have cited? And then just a general comment, Chair. You know, look, I have picked up that maybe some of the presenters here might be attending some sessions for the first time. And I'm getting worried that if we don't clarify processes of the committee or how committee is processing submissions, people might go out of this house a bit confused as to the position of the committee. Because the rest of the matter is that the product that emerges out of our submissions as individual public representatives in this committee is a composite product comprised of various inputs from various political parties driven by various political ideologies. So I think it is very, very clear. It becomes very, very important to me, Chair. I need to really indicate, most especially to those who are first-time presenters here, some of the opinions that you hear, or maybe some of the questions that are coming from individual members, that doesn't constitute the position of the committee. The committee still needs to sit and discuss and obviously consider your submissions and apply its mind before it, everything is enacted. And I thought it's very important, Chair, for me to bring in this aspect because I can see that the institutions like Old Mutual are coming here for the first time in the past 5 years. You know, so I, maybe I thought the faces might be new. So it's important that we reiterate how the process of committee works. So as people don't get out of this house being confused and sending wrong messages, I mean, to the outside world. Thank you very much.
And also, moreover, in this particular set of circumstances, an informal process will haven't been, those haven't been formally taken. So I take it you're aware, I mean, we're 21 years in democracy. This is an exploratory exchange. Even within the same party, you might get different points of view. If you take a majority party, we're a very broad front. We're not a conventional, narrow political party that operates in a parliamentary terrain, recognized as a major party. So, you know, here we're asking questions, we're engaging, we're seeking clarity. There's no formal positions here. That will begin to emerge over the next few weeks. All right, over then to Pinky.
Thank you, Chair. And I think what you and the whip for the committee have said is very profound and very necessary. The I think the other area where Comrade Des has also covered me is on the issue of the recourse mechanism. But also, just to say, especially on the presentation that was done by KPMG on the turnaround time to get responses and other things, surely if that is happening, should be a cause for concern for us as well as members of the standing committee. But there's also another aspect that I want to, like we're saying, it's an engagement, it's a public hearing where we're not taking decisions. But I thought we'll take decisions later anyway based on some of the things that members have said. I thought one of the things that I would suggest that you also exploit, especially around the picture you have painted on research and development. It's a worrisome picture if this is obtaining in the South African context. And the fact that other people see India being a better option to do research and development and coming back. I'm happy the chair said there are young people who are here from universities, and I think they are also listening on the challenges that we have in as far as, in as far as issues of research and development is concerned. But the other aspect, Chair, that I thought companies like KPMG should also exploit around issues of R&D, while you have the platform of engagement with science and technology and SARS and National Treasury, I think it will also be critical for you to engage with the DTI because they are also interested in other aspects of investment and issues that can also grow the economy. Higher education will also be very critical because some of the things that you deal with in as far as R&D is concerned also impacts on some of the contents and other research and development activities that higher education is doing. So in that way, you'll be mobilizing very critical stakeholders who can now come into the picture and then be able to deal with the matter accordingly. I've also noted it, and it means even from our side as the standing committee, we have to really broaden the level of engagement with some of the relevant portfolio committees on matters of R&D. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Sure.
the issue of the tax-free savings accounts and the quality of the drafting in that respect, I mean, while it might be debatable, if you like, as to whether or not there should be further incentives, if you like, for savings that go beyond what is currently proposed, the problem with the drafting is that the outcome of what has been drafted is not the current policy intention of Treasury. So that's the problem that we are pointing out. If there is an intention or there's a change of intention to make all interest, dividends and capital gains non-taxable, then that legislation as it's drafted might be go some way to achieving that, but as I said, that's not the intention. On the question of the Davis Committee and the small business proposals, I think it certainly is a case that, in our view, the inclusion of the proposals in this year's legislation has jumped the gun. I believe it would be preferable to allow the Davis Committee to conclude its research and issue a final report in that regard following the consultations that are still to take place on the interim report. On the issue of the retirement fund capping, there has been significant consultations with SARS and National Treasury that took place during the course of last year on those caps. Unfortunately, from our point of view, if you like, there has been no movement whatsoever on the part of National Treasury in that, and they're sticking to their guns on those caps. That's not to say that this committee is not free to apply its own mind to that conclusion, and that is what we're suggesting, is that the committee should consider whether or not, from its own point of view, those caps are appropriate. There was an issue raised around the incentives for complying with the law in relation to the compliance rebates, if you like, for the small businesses. I'm not sure if there was a question posed there, but if I may respond to it as such, the point that we were making is that it's not appropriate to reward persons for complying with the obligations. And while I understand that there might be an issue around knowledge of what is required in order to comply with the law, it's not a case that issuing a rebate or reward for complying is the mechanism to address that. The mechanisms to address it should rather be making it easier to comply, which is certainly a policy or approach that has been adopted by SARS up to this point. And the second issue is about educating taxpayers on what they need to do to comply, which again, SARS has been doing, and maybe they can do more. But that's the approach that should be adopted as opposed to handing out incentives. I'll ask my colleagues just to address the other two issues on 23M and VAT, if I may.
Okay. I'll talk a little bit about Section 23M very quickly. But just to continue just very quickly the point that Kyle was just making about incentivizing taxpayers to comply, I do want to be quite clear that SARS's success to date has not been on the basis of saying to taxpayers, we will pay you to comply. They have been phenomenally successful, but it's really been on the basis of we won't punish you. So the VDP program has been hugely successful, but it's been on the basis of saying to taxpayers, please come regularize your affairs. There won't be criminal charges. We won't punish you. There won't be penalties. So that has been very successful. But this thing of saying to taxpayers, we will pay you to obey the law is unprecedented in this country. So I do want that to be a clear point. The other question, then just very quickly on Section 23M, just to clarify that I am certainly not suggesting that the principle being addressed in Section 23M should be abandoned, or we shouldn't go there. I am saying 23M as one of the tools should be abandoned, yes, in its entirety, but in context, just keep in mind that the principle of having a tax avoidance mechanism to attack abusive, excessive interest, that South Africa's already there. Just in the last 3 years, we've had Section 23K, we've had Section 23N. As we speak now, we have a draft interpretation note by SARS still outstanding on thin capitalization. So all I'm saying is this principle, this aspect, yes, it must be addressed,
But we actually have the tools in this legislation already. Why are we putting on top of it something new, which is not going to achieve anything more? So I don't want people to think that I'm saying, oh, big corporate shouldn't be watching their interest expenditure. I'm just saying that this one last tool that's being added on top of it doesn't achieve anything. Charles.
Chair, if I could maybe just make two short points about the agriculture. The one is that in respect of emerging farmers, this amendment doesn't affect them at all because they are currently paying VAT on that amount, so that won't change. And there is a mechanism and then precedent for doing that, specifically in the cane farmers space, for example, so they can be assisted on that basis. I think in terms of the specific mechanisms, a lot of it is just about reporting and disclosure. So it's registering the supplier so that you know who's making those supplies and it's not any VAT vendor, and also putting information on the VAT return so that you can see, the risk engine that SARS has got will very quickly identify the discrepancies in that place. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Two key questions. First of all, one needs to bear in mind that what Old Mutual is investing here is not shareholder money. What Old Mutual gets out of the investments that we do is simply fees. So 23M makes no difference on whether Old Mutual gets more profit or less profit on this whatsoever. It's absolutely neutral in terms of Old Mutual's profitability. The people who suffer are pension funds. Okay, and the policyholders. And it is not just Old Mutual policyholders who do that. It is also GEPF, Government Employees Pension Fund. We manage their money as well, and they pay us a fee to do exactly the same. So it's essentially the person who will lose out here is the individual pension fund participant, not Old Mutual. Secondly, if we look at schools, which is, as I emphasize, is only one aspect of what we do, because we also do housing, we do everything in terms of the financial sector charter. So the maximum fees schools that we would invest in can't charge more than $15,000 a year. So we are aiming at people who cannot afford Model C, certainly can't go to Crawford's, certainly can't go to Bishops or any of the big, absolutely elite private schools, but are trying to get a better quality education at their income level. So it's within the financial sector charter space. Similarly, in the housing, we are attempting to deliver housing just above the RDP level. So in other words, in the FLIS and in the gap market. So we are not producing multi-million rand houses, where in fact I think the impact of 23M most probably wouldn't really be felt, okay, not materially. But for the lower the income level that you are trying to do an investment into, the greater the impact of 23M. And it's the impact is two ways. It's either that the individual person who has the pension gets a lower return, okay, or alternatively, we have to charge more to the low-income person who we are trying to serve so that they pay more. The other issue is exactly what do we invest in? We do not invest in operating companies. So we don't invest in like a Crawford. But BASA, who need more schools, in other words, they need the physical structure to be able to expand their education. They manage the operating, getting the school, getting the teachers, getting everything else. We set quality requirements in terms of their operating. But we go and build the school, okay? And our investment is in that physical property. So again, this is not high-end. It is a typical project finance vehicle aimed at the low end of the market. And it's at the low end of the market where the interface between the pensioner getting less money or the low-income person paying more to compensate for 23M. it has no impact on Old Mutual. Old Mutual, what we do in Old Mutual is tiny. They could choose to throw us out tomorrow because we're no longer, you know, people no longer. GPS, DBSA, Eskom Pension Fund no longer want to give us money to manage. So that's not where the crux of the problem is. It's the conflict between, does the pensioner take the bath or does the low-income person take the bath?
Okay. Thank you very much for your questions. I'm glad there were quite a few questions, and I'm glad this stimulates a lot of debate. It is, I'm very passionate about it. It's quite something that we need to discuss, and I appreciate you saying that let's find each other on that. You mentioned the Royfalk, and you mentioned that other countries, sorry, I'm addressing it to you for your question, that other countries are actually beating us to the punch. Okay. We need to encourage our economy and our participants in our economy, whether it be multinationals who are based here or local South African companies, to actually invest more R&D in South Africa rather than to relocate that to other regions. So the way the subjective nature of reviewing an application that is before the committee, and this is the committee of the DST, what they say is, and this is what I find astounding, if it has been done before somewhere else, it is not unique, it is not novel, it is not innovative, it falls out. So simply put, if a company like Danel, for example, had to go and manufacture Royfalk, which is the helicopter, but because America already developed an Apache helicopter, even the development that was done in South Africa for Royfalk would not qualify for the incentive, because it's been done somewhere else. And that's the point I'm trying to make, that the high threshold that has been applied at a subjective level by the committee members is to say, is it unique to the world? And if you are saying that we are already there as a country, that we are already such an advanced economy that we can pay someone on not even the moon, but Mars, then I go ahead and retain that policy. Because even if we develop a space program to rival NASA, we will not get the incentive because it's been done before. Okay. You talked about Ebola and trying to defeat Ebola. Let me also mention to you, and I say this in jest only, that there was a virus around a couple of years ago called SARS as well. Okay. Okay. Moving on to the recourse mechanisms that you guys spoke about. We have investigated it. We've taken legal opinion on this. The decision by the Minister of Science and Technology to accept or decline a project, and mostly, obviously, it applies to a declining of a project, is final. There is nothing else that can be done except writing a letter to the Minister saying, please come and explain yourself in the High Court. That is where it is. Okay. So dealing with the Ombudsman, we'd love that to be done. Dealing with any other organization that may be helpful, we'd love to do that. We have already engaged with National Treasury on this. We've engaged with the Department of Science and Technology. I've got a meeting with the Minister of Science and Technology, Honorable Pandor, on Friday on this matter. Okay, so these are serious matters. And let me make one thing clear. The Department of Science and Technology does an astoundingly well job. They have been under pressure like you cannot believe. There's more than 10,000 applications that have been submitted. So it's expected to be a long delay, but the delay is expounded by this, to me, the irrational sense of whatever you're trying to achieve, even though it meets the definition of R&D in a tax legislation, is overruled by the subjective notion of it has to be new to the world. So that is what I'm pleading for. Let us say, let sanity prevail. Let us not have that as the be-all and end-all of whether an R&D application should be accepted. Moving on to your question of cash flow impact. There are grants that the government do give, the TRIP grant and a few other grants that different individual organizations give. But these grants are small in comparison to really incentivizing what companies need to invest in. The R&D incentive, as it currently stands, is almost unique to the rest of the world. The rest of the world says you don't even have to apply for a pre-approval. There's legislation, there's certainty, you apply for it. I'll give you an example. In Australia, you've got the Australian Tax Office, and then you've got Oz Industry. Oz Industry is their equivalent of our Department of Science and Technology. They do not need pre-approval. They submit their application. After they submitted their tax return to Oz Industry, Oz Industry sends their technology, their scientists to go and review the application, and if it is found that it doesn't meet their requirements, there's an adjustment made to their tax claim. What we have found here is companies are not even willing to participate because there's uncertainty whether they're even going to get accepted, whether the high thresholds that are going to apply in terms of it being new to the world will really be overcome. And I've got a lot of examples on this. We've got companies in South Africa who are really putting a lot of investment in hiring new engineers. And what they are saying is in this environment when people are talking about recession, cutbacks, there is no incentive to hire any new technical person. There is nothing to fund that. So the policy of Parliament is really what I'm after. If it is a policy, and this is already in the legislation, Section 11D17, very rare that we have the intention of Parliament in the legislation, but it's in the legislation already. The intention is, and I'll read it out to you, the intention is to increase employment, increase skills, and increase and enable to achieve government's broader objectives. That's the intention already embodied in legislation. And my saying is the way it is going about, the subjective nature applied by the committee members is contrary to what is happening. We are going to have less people applying for it. And my final point on this is if we had to make a rule that the intellectual property derived from the research and development to be undertaken in South Africa has to remain in South Africa, we can close the door on all FDI investment and R&D in South Africa. No one in their right mind will want to go and invest in a country where the intellectual property will not be able to access. So it's not a requirement of the legislation. Okay. Thank you very much.
Carry it over, because we're going to erode into, I think the committee needs to discuss this issue. Are we going to meet from 10 to 1, or do we need to meet for longer hours and so on? We must be, we'll review our decisions, but if we agree on these things, we have to do it the way we have. Now, National Treasury, can you give you, and SARS can give you minutes of replies? I think it's to be very brief, but Signal is not your final reply, so National Treasury, start with you.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. I'm going to respond based on what has been raised. Firstly, the tax receiving account and the quality of drafting. We welcome the criticism. We can only improve based on criticism. But we are meeting with the industry. We are having workshops next week whereby we'll clarify the issues and improve the quality of drafting. With regard to the Small Business Corporation, as we have said yesterday, that we're going to consider this, we're going to look at it because it goes hand in hand with the Davis Committee submission. And then with regard to the retirement cap, this was not in the 2014 bill, as they said that it was in the 2013 legislation, and yet they thought that we're going to look at it this year. But we've been having engagements with the private sector regarding retirement. And then with regard to R&D, Section 11D was first introduced in 2006, and since then we have made a lot of changes in Section 11D based on what the industry is suggesting. And we, for instance, this year we've made so many changes in the R&D. So we are engaging with the industry. We are, tomorrow we are meeting with the Department of Science and Technology to iron out some of the things that have emerged in these presentations. And then we'll still meet with the industry in the workshops, and then we'll clarify some of the issues. With regard to the threshold that is high, that is a policy decision that needs to be taken. I cannot answer this here. And then with regard to Section 23M and the request by KPMG that it should be removed entirely, as we have said that they've pointed so many things, so request by PwC, they pointed so many things that we've got Section 31, we've got other issues. As we have said yesterday, Section 31 addresses another issue and Section 23M addresses another issue. And it is important to note that the interest is deferred. It is not lost. If it's above the limit, it's rolled over to the following year. It's not like you cannot deduct the interest. And I'll let Johan also to expand on Section 23M.
Thank you.
Chair, I can maybe just mention the interest limitation rules. We had these rules in different forms since 1995 already. And then, as Osman mentioned, 2011, we brought in more stricter rules even. And then last year, 23M was introduced, so it was actually part of the 2013 legislative cycle. So all of that is actually not linked to the BEPS project at all. We had our own homegrown solutions. And then as Cecil Morden mentioned yesterday, the issue of the guarantees, we are sympathetic to the concerns raised. Maybe just another point, sorry, Chair, I'm from SARS, actually. Yeah, that's right. On the R&D, the committee, there's actually a good reason for SARS to be presented on the committee, because the relief is actually built into the Income Tax Act. So actually we need to be present to actually be involved in the interpretation of it. So if Department of Science and Technology wants to give a pure grant, then there's no need for SARS to be involved.
One is, and I haven't asked any questions because there isn't the space or time to do so. In fact, you'll notice I haven't been asking questions, just pulling things together. Now, the committee members, we need to apply our minds to this. What time do you want to start a committee meeting and what time do you want to end? But we must stick by whatever decisions we take. You've got a 12:30 meeting here, so do I have chairs, but I'll stay till 1. But at 1 o'clock promptly we stop. I think the committee needs to apply its mind. I'm raising this because it's not easy chairing the sessions with yesterday. So I think we have an internal meeting next week and decide. We can start at 8 o'clock, after 7 in the morning, then we stick by till 1 o'clock. But if we're going to manage time, and that's a crucial thing in this parliament, it's abysmally poor in managing time. At least while I'm here, we're going to do it the way the rules require. If you start at 10, we start at 10. And I've only once been late in this entire year because I was held up by the chief whip. So let's play by the rules. And I think the members must start by being more pointed and precise. In fact, to be fair to the people on this side, most of them have been very pointed and precise. Now, I do not know this area. And what I'm saying, as Vez rightly pointed out, is we're exploring this thing. But it does seem to me that R&D, I mean, Tandy is very experienced. This is a former deputy minister in this area, and she knows the area very well. So my views are tentative. They are cautious. But my feeling is that, from what I know, R&D is completely underdeveloped in this country. It comes up everywhere. So what I would like to suggest is it's not a tax issue fundamentally. It's really a science and technology issue. You need to apply your mind. I don't have a view. But it would seem to me there should be one SARS person there. But primarily, that's the decision that should be taken, seems to me, by science and technology. What does a SARS person really know? Apart from the tax implications, right? But what do you really know about science? What do you really know about what constitutes innovative and so on, right? Secondly, in this country, apartheid is gone now, right? 21 years later, people should have the right of recourse. I don't trust these people, basically. And most of the people who come here, I did a property rate bill. 300, everybody said, if we introduce property rates, the skies will fall down. Right? I'm back to that era of 2004. The skies didn't fall down. So obviously, what is happening here is normal. Any democracy, go to Britain as well, your counterpart will be saying, no, if you introduce this tax, the whole world will collapse. Right? The economy will collapse. Jobs will be lost and so on. Right? Jobs will be lost and so on. Now, that's par for the course. Right? So, now let's come back to this. On this thing, I remain unconvinced, but my comrades here and my colleagues may convince that actually you need equal weight given the GST and so on. Experts at DST and the industry. SARS has to look at all the subterfuge and all that. That you must do because we don't trust KPMG either. But the second thing to say also is on the zero rating, right? These things, can you come back to us at the end, National Treasury? These proposals that people make, and they try to say, they're not very precise. What is your response to them? For example, Price Waterhouse has made about 4 or 5 proposals, I think, is it, that don't do what you're doing. This is the way to deal with it. Fraud and corruption of the cell, $600 million. Mm-hmm. I would like you to respond to that, because in a similar way, other people have raised that, 15 that's coming up. And one of our members, I don't feel very strongly that AgriSAS, they made a good case. Well, here we are. What I'm saying in short is, we have our own internal issues we're going to resolve next week, because I don't want to be harassed. You tell me when you want to meet, I'm cool. I've got my own car, by the way. I can drive it anytime I want. You guys are going to be stuck in the bus system. But remember one thing, you're starting at 6:30 in the morning. Nobody can come late. 5 minutes at most. I don't want people coming in at 10. So, in short, we have cut into the time of the people in the second half of the session, but however, we will catch up somehow. Motor Industry Bargaining Council. Where are you? Good, go for it, thank you. Because I really would like to reply,
thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, for the opportunity. Our focus is mainly on, I'm not going to bore you with all the other details, is on Section 12L on the VAT VAT exemption issue. The Bargaining Council falls within the political organizations, the employer organizations, and trade unions. For a long time, Bargaining Council did not have any exemption in terms of tax, while you have public sector Bargaining Council having the that kind of an exemption. So that's the issue that we've had. But fortunately, last year, we were able to get the legislation being promulgated. But the biggest issue for us is the fact that that same promulgation provided some uncertainties in terms of the financial management within bargaining councils, and that mainly is related to tax liability, and we've been having financial tensions with our auditors, and we can't really say whether we owe SARS money or we do not owe SARS money. And we've submitted our VAT ruling, which have taken longer to be looked at. And so that's where we are at. And therefore, we are grateful that this year we then got an opportunity for the revision of the certain clauses that are there. So we've consulted with some of other bargaining councils, and I've just mentioned them there. And I'll just go straight into the issue, into the next slide. That we need to first go direct to the issue of the fact that bargaining councils are established in terms of the Act, and they've got certain powers and functions. And what is concerning within bargaining councils is that there are a number of legislations that are seem to be eroding the actual functions of the bargaining council vis-a-vis the VAT. Tax exemption. And then also the commencement date, which is 1st April 2015, we know that we can't go back many, many other years, but since you've got an act that has taken place last year, we would like that to be looked at. The new proposal mainly, just to go back, bargaining councils usually have got all these small little things that they do, like the leave pay issues, because, for example, we've got about just below 300,000 employees that are really on a low pay, and we've got about 21,000 in my bargaining council, and 95% of the employers are small, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 employees, and generally the employer does not have the luxury of an HR officer, industrial relations officer, and all these nice things that you find in the big companies. So the then the benefit of a bargaining council is that it can deal with all these issues in terms of the basic conditions of employees, and therefore deal with it in terms of sick pay, if employees are sick, leave pay, in terms of the payment of the bonuses towards the end of the year, holiday pay, and all other schemes that bargaining council have, including issues that are related to unemployment issues. For example, we've got retailers in our sectors that usually close down for a period of 3 to 6 months. You see sometimes the garages close down. Employees don't necessarily get paid during that period of time. So as bargaining council, we usually have got schemes that are looking at that and making sure that those employees are taken care of. So then our main issue is just the issue of the commencement date and also the clause. The proposal suggested to the extent that the consideration for supply consists of membership contributions be deleted. But the VAT exemption will be in respect of this, and it now proposes that the VAT, the new clause, the supply of any goods and services by a bargaining council to any of its members without limiting to constraints of an arbitrary term such as membership contribution. The limitation in the current exemption to the extent that the consideration for supply consists of membership contribution has mixed understanding in the industry and even with our auditors when they are auditing us. And mainly because the membership contribution is not defined and it's capable of a number of interpretations, because the monies that we receive are from our members, and the members, it includes the employer contribution and the employee contribution. So it means, for example, for a bargaining council to exist, we will have levies that, you know, it would be 50 cents this side, 50 cents this side, and that amount of money then comes through to us, and we do a whole range of things, including compliance, for example, because as we all know, the Department of Labor does not have the capacity to do the enforcement and ensuring that the employers are paying the wages that have been agreed to in terms of the bargaining council. So we do all those things. We do dispute resolution processes. We are accredited by CCMA because, again, with the CCMA, there's a lot of work that that happens, that the cases takes longer. Within the bargaining council, we are much more efficient. We do our cases within a short space of time. We deal with about 12,000 cases in my bargaining council per annum, of which CCMA would have not been able to do, and we only get a subsidy of about 1.5 million rand per annum, but we use over 23 million rand for dispute resolution within the bargaining council itself. So those are sort of issues that we deal with. Then we also are finding that the explanatory notes that we have are not really helpful and are rather a bit vague in the new proposal that has been put in. The reason for change seems to refer to sick pay, leave pay, holiday pay fund, and does not explain why the phrase. So it does not explain why we're changing the phrase and why it needs to be deleted. The proposal now exempt administration services that have long been supplied by bargaining councils to members. What generally happens is that the amount of money that we receive and for the work that we are doing, we need to have some administrative fee in order to pay the employees that are working within the bargaining council to have a building and do everything else. While we're receiving this money, we probably make money from the interest that we are making, and then from that amount of money, we take a certain percentage of that money for administration fee so that the employees are able to deal with the claims, pay back, go out there and do the enforcement and compliance. And that's where the issues are coming through in terms of the VAT liability. And there is no clarity with regards to that. I'm not going to go into detail. Let's go back and then... the commencement date, therefore, will leave bargaining council with an uncertain period for effective date of the current exemption. which is 1 January up until April next year. So it means for this period where the legislation has been promulgated, we'll be left with a tax liability within SAFPRA. Hence, we are requesting the retrospective implementation of the Act. The comment on the explanatory memorandum is background dealing with the bargaining council is also unclear. It is important to note that one of the powers of the bargaining council in terms of 21(1)(g) of the Labor Relations Act is that it can establish and administer pension, provident fund, medical aid, sick pay, holiday, unemployment, and training scheme or funds of any scheme or funds for the benefit of one or more of the parties to the bargaining council or their members. That's what bargaining councils are all about, and that is why I was talking earlier about the erosion and the fact that we do require this kind of an exemption so that we are clear about what we are supposed to be doing. And consistency, because those bargaining councils that are sitting within the public sector are VAT exempt, and they don't have issues that we have as private bargaining councils. Just to share with you, bargaining councils, you've got what you call the public sector bargaining councils, you've got what is called statutory bargaining councils. The statutory bargaining councils are those that are determined by the minister on the basis of what they see in the industry, and then you've got those ones where voluntarily employers and employees on their own decide to form bargaining councils. The sick leave and holiday pay fund or similar fund exist as a result of the power which bargaining council will exercise in terms of the Section 28, as I've mentioned to you. And the view is that these funds actually exist within the bargaining council, and they are merely an extension of the relevant bargaining council. So what we've been seeing is that because we are managing these funds within the bargaining council, the SARS and our auditors have been looking at these funds as separate entities from bargaining councils, and therefore they are liable for tax. And we are saying, no, they are not. We've been given powers in terms of this section, Text 28 of the Labor Relations Act, to do what we are supposed to be doing. Therefore, we need to be exempt as a bargaining council, and we need clarity on that particular issue. It follows, therefore, that the services this fund supplied to its members were funded by consideration, which consists of contribution by members. Therefore, the current exemption in terms of the Section 12L was also extended to these contributions. It seems from the reason for change that the explanatory memorandum that it is stated that there is currently no provision in the Act to exempt the supply in respect of which contribution are made to this fund, but may be disregarded by the explanatory note, and that these funds exist because the special power of the bargaining council in terms of Section 28 of the Labor Relations Act, and any other supply of services to its members. The memorandum further states that these funds should enjoy the same tax benefit as the super annuation schemes, but no corresponding amendment is proposed to give effect to this. Mainly, for example, your sick and maternity fund, they are looked at as sort of super annuation schemes by SARS. Therefore, but we are not seeing it in the new amendment that is coming through. We are therefore suggesting that the current amendment that has been put in place, that it be firstly the retrospective as from the 1st of January 2013, and it should read like this: the supply of any goods and services by a bargaining council in respect of powers and functions in relation to its scope as set out in Section 28(1)(a) to L of the Labor Relations Act 1995, and the supply of any goods and services by any sick, holiday, unemployment, training scheme or funds or any similar scheme or funds for the benefit of one or more of the parties to the bargaining councils on their members established and administered in terms of Section 28(1)(g) of the Labour Relations Act. And we hope that this will therefore clear the uncertainty that we have at the moment. Thank you.
Committee on Finance. I'm here with my colleague Manish Nitya, and we basically want to present the views of the smallholder farmers with regard to the repeal on the zero rating for agricultural inputs. We come from AFASA, which is the African Farmers Association of South Africa, so it's a union representing your smallholder farmers in South Africa, and we have membership from all 9 provinces, and like any other farmers association, our objective is to articulate, represent, protect, and develop the economic interests of our members. I've put there the structure of the organization just to indicate to you how we want to be structured. We normally start down at grassroots level with your study groups, form the commodity associations, which then form the main body. But we also have commodity chambers in the association as well as the cooperative chamber. We've tried to sort of profile the farmers of South Africa, which hasn't really been an easy task because we don't have detailed information on that. But on the whole, I think the estimates are that there are about 30,000-35,000 commercial farmers in the country, and these are well-established third-generation, fourth-generation farmers that have been going in the country, and they have good markets nationally and globally, well-organized structures. And they have title deeds that have also been passed on from generation to generation, basically. And then you have what we call first-generation commercial farmers that really sort of emerged with the democracy that are coming into commercial farming. We estimate that you've got about 2,000, really, that you can call commercial farmers. Most of them are on state land, leasing the state land, very few on owned land. They have weak farmer structures with inadequate capacity on policy and legislative matters, and they use mainly manual labor and outdated technology. And then the vast majority of the people working on the land are your smallholder farmers, and I think according to the household survey of 2011, it's estimated that there are 2,800,000 of those on communal land, mainly communal land, tribal land management, and they're very ineffective in influencing policy, and they're very heavily dependent on the state. So those are the three categories of farmers that we think we have. So of those, I think your commercial farmers, from what I've heard this morning, the Agri-SA has been here, Potato SA has been here, and I think they've really stated the case for the commercial farmers with regard to zero rating on the 6 items, input items. Of what we call your first-generation farmers, some of them are
VET registered. So they will be affected just as any other commercial farmer with a zero rating. And then your vast majority of the farmers on the land, they are not registered at all. So in fact, all of them are virtually paying VET on all their agricultural inputs. So what we're saying is that, as I've already said, your category A commercial farmers enjoyed many concessions during the apartheid and pre-deregulation era in agriculture, which is what led them to be where they are today. Then in your category B and C, which is what we call your emerging farmers and your smallholder, basically most subsistence farmers, are attempting to enter the commercial market. But it's a big challenge for them because they're doing it in a free market system. And in the free market system, they're expected to raise both capital and production loans at market-related interest rates and be able to pay them back. And when they pay back these interests, they're paying the loan, the VAT, and the interest on both the loan and the VAT. And most of them, as I've already indicated, are not VET registered because of the cumbersome process and basically lack of knowledge on how to go about it. So they'll end up with high cost of production, but vis-a-vis your low economies of scale. So you have a high cost of production, low economies of scale, so they're really in a tight cost price squeeze. And then there are other factors that affect them, which are probably not much to do with this committee, but the extension, access to training, and access to all other services basically tend to be weak for them, and that sets them up for failure. And the size of a proportion of them depend heavily on agriculture for household food and for household income. And hence, they could do really with some relief in the cost. And I've just drawn from some work that have been done by our colleagues in the academic sector. This is work, sorry, let me just go back for one slide. I think I'm too quick or too slow, whichever one. All right, I'll start with this one. This is what that was done by Ben Cousins. I don't know if some of you know him. But basically what he's illustrating there is that you've got, one, a large pool of commercial farmers, okay, 30,000 odd, but a very large pool of your subsistence farmers. And out of that, what is really missing in South Africa is this middle link of your emerging farmers. And those are coming from the large-scale commercial farms, especially with the land reform process. You're getting a small people with sort of medium-sized enterprises, as well as your subsistence farmers that are coming into the sector. So that's the group that we're talking about. And if we stifle them in terms of cost of production, I think we'll just generally squeeze the development of that middle group. Then the other thing that I wanted to illustrate that I've already talked about is the income from household to the household coming from agriculture. This was work done by Machete in Limpopo, and I think it equally applies really to any province, where he says on average, your smallholder farmers, 41% of their income comes from farming activities. So they basically buying the input so that they can supply, they can get income from the house, and in addition also to supply the household with food. This is work done again by Ben Cousins that he shows us that most of your households that are engaged in agriculture, that food that they produce goes into household food security. Either it's the main source of food or it's the extra source of food. And it also, as I already indicated, contributes to the income. So just based on those observations and from what has been said by the established commercial sector through Agri-SA, Potato SA, we say that the removal of the zero rating will increase the cost price squeeze on farmers who are registered for VAT and negatively impact on the sustainability of the sector and national food security. And we then say that I think we should continue with the exemption on all the six input items that I listed. But we also suggest that we should consider a 14% subsidy for smallholder farmers in order to level the playing field for them. As I already indicated, they are paying the tax, and I think that came out earlier on in the meeting, that they're already contributing anyway to this VAT, but they're not getting any return from it. So in fact, it means that their cost of production is high. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. This is the presentation that we have for you.
Very much. Very clear. Very precise. This is all we need. I hope all of us are listening, including people on my left, including people here. Okay. I don't know what thinks he's here in the tech, so I know it's to me. But remember, I cannot notice when your hand goes up in you, so it's not safe to tackle the chair.
I think that's good to say, communist or what?
You must think lens here. Okay, right. Doesn't mean as a Brunis, you can take the time, okay? 12 minutes, wherever you are. All right, over to you as a Brunis, wherever you are.
Yeah.
Ah, yes.
The VA is not yet ready.
Are you ready? You come to make an input, right?
Sorry, yes.
Yes, so do it then. Yeah, yeah. What's your answer, members, about Samir Tawfiq? You say anything, can't you?
No, I agree fully with you.
I didn't say anything, I put a question.
No, it's a suggestion you have made.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That week will be ideal for us to
Alright, so in that case, are we agreeing?
Yeah.
In that case, who are we going to send to the Northwest?
Agree or not?
We're not putting the question again. People are not going to say that's their problem. Now, who are we going to send? David says, Sandy, you know, she's not one of the four. It's time to go childcare responsibility.
No, it's a week. It's a community week. You guys should say.
Why don't you go, Dicker Lady? It's your province of anything.
No, it's not. But why do you just come?
Because we have to take decisions.
All
right, look, can we agree? Okay, let's agree on this. Sorry?
Okay.
Can we agree with one person?
Yeah.
And we have a committee meeting?
Yeah.
So we mandate Alan and whatever. Are you ready? Go for it. Alan and Peter Paul to talk that matter out.
Okay. All right. Honourable members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you here this morning. We are here to talk about the Small Business Funding Entity. So I will start off by just giving you a little bit of background. I'll start off by giving you a bit of background on the SAB Foundation. And I'm supported here by my colleagues Sizwe Nzima from IESA Express, who will also speak to you a little bit later. So the South African Breweries Foundation mandate was set up in 2010, and it is a purely philanthropic vehicle. It was part of South African Breweries' ownership deal, where they 8.5 million shares were given to the foundation, and the dividends from that every year are used to give grant funding to small businesses. Essentially, you can see the mandate up there. It is to contribute to the economic and social empowerment of historically disadvantaged communities through community development, primarily by means of entrepreneurship development. And the priority focus for the foundation is on women, youth in rural areas, as well as people with disabilities. I think this is very obvious to everyone sitting here, but, you know, we have the belief that entrepreneurship...
I can't see that. Can I have a copy? Which is that?
You know, we obviously believe that entrepreneurship is a source of economic growth, as well as a primary source of innovation and job creation. And in addition, it builds the backbone of a healthy democracy. The foundation mandate was set up based on some research which shows that South Africa has a critical, it lacks a critical mass of small and medium-sized enterprises, and it largely lacks entrepreneurial role models, and that the culture of innovation is largely untapped and uncommercialized. So the foundation therefore aims to contribute to the development of a culture of entrepreneurship in South Africa by supporting the growth of a critical mass of SMEs, developing entrepreneurial role models, and stimulating and rewarding innovation, and specifically social innovation. So I'm sorry, the slide is a little bit small, but it really just demonstrates we have two funds. We have the Tawana Enterprise Fund and the Social Innovation Awards, which are the two main priority areas for the foundation. The Tawana Fund focuses on startup businesses. We give them a maximum of 250,000 rand. They only have to have been operating for 6 months, and this is a grant that we give them to help them with their capital expenditure or any other needs that they have to become successful businesses. On the social innovation side, we reward social innovators who are coming up with products or services that benefit low-income communities, specifically women, youth, and people in rural areas, and those with disabilities. So since 2011, we supported over 207 businesses with an investment of approximately 31 million rand, and we've created over 1,500 jobs in that the entrepreneurs have gone on to employ people post our investment, and it's 1,500 more people than they employed when we made the investment. We also provide an ecosystem of support. We really try and obviously mentoring, we all know business development support and mentoring is critical to the success of small businesses, so we do a lot of that as well. That is also funded by the SAB Foundation at no cost to the entrepreneur. I just wanted to place an emphasis here on the kinds of areas that we are investing in entrepreneurs. I think in my mind this makes us fairly unique in that it really is our aim. We've started a geo map, and our aim is really to try to get to the most unresourced areas of South Africa and really try and flush out talented entrepreneurs in these areas. And just this slide just shows some of the places that we've invested in entrepreneurs. I still think there's big geographic gaps in terms of where we are, but we are really making an effort to try and get to those areas. So these are just some examples of the entrepreneurs we've funded, really small startup businesses for the most part. Bottom left is WeTrust, which is a trust that supports women who've been victims of domestic violence and really tries to help them set up their own businesses so they can become independent of an abusive spouse. Then the other businesses are all very small. And you can see their welding companies, a woman who started a small fashion business in her home, an IT e-commerce, I mean, not e-commerce, an e-learning solution. And then through our innovation awards, we Pimp My Book Network, I don't know if you've heard of them, but he buys secondhand textbooks and has created a market for those by selling cheap textbooks to people who don't have them. We've supported an agriculture project in Mthatha. The top right one is provides wheelchairs, customized wheelchairs for disabled people, and also works with disability in disadvantaged areas. And then bottom right is a whole range of alternative energy projects which provide cheap energy for low-income communities. So I'm going to hand over now to Sizwe Nzima, who's one of our beneficiaries, just so he can tell you a little bit about his own business and what SAB Foundation did for his business.
Good morning, honorable members. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Just to introduce myself, my name is Sizwe Nzima. I was born and bred in Khayelitsha. Grew up with my grandparents, my mom living in Joburg. I'm currently 22 years old. I'll be turning 23 in December. I run a business called EASA Express. To explain in depth what is EASA Express, it's a bicycle courier service that mainly focuses on collecting chronic medication parcels from public hospitals and local clinics and delivers it to the patient's doorstep. Our main goal is that we believe in making, you know, encouraging adherence, but the first step to encourage adherence is in fact collection, because you cannot adhere to your medication if you find it difficult to collect it. We understand, I've been, you know, growing up with my grandparents, the idea came about a personal experience where I had to go and collect chronic medication for my grandma every single month. It was three times, so it was like three times in a month, and I had to go and sit in those queues while I had to go to school, so I had to sit in queues. So I understand the process of actually sitting and waiting for hours at public hospitals. So then that's when the idea came about. And then I entered the SAB Foundation competition. I still had an idea then. So I didn't know where I'm going to get the funds to actually start the business. And when I entered, you know, as I progressed, I went to the finals, the top 25, and I got a grant funding for 100,000 rand seed grant funding. That helped me to kickstart my business, because without that, I wouldn't have been here, because that was the first time I was actually operational. Because I still remember I used to walk to my clients when I had no bikes, I had no uniform, I had no bags, I had no phone. I still just had to walk, but I was using my grandma's phone. So after the funding came and, you know, things started changing, I started buying new bicycles, I started
getting staff on board. Now currently I'm still located in Khayelitsha. We're serving for 718 patients at two local clinics, but within the next 3 months we're going to be moving into other four clinics, because there's six clinics in Khayelitsha in total, and I currently employ six staff, two ladies and four guys. And these guys have just got basic skills. They don't have degrees. And for me, I believe, you know, the guy sitting at the corner, some people might say they have nothing to do. But I'm telling you, if you ask that guy who is number 5 Avenue Street, he'll tell you. And so I use the basic skills that they have to actually earn a living for themselves instead of going and doing crime. So that's what we do at the moment. The main goal for my business is to actually grow from, you know, township to every township, because it's focused on township logistics. You know, big companies, you know, they find it very difficult to actually locate the maze of the township. But, you know, that's what we are there for years, especially, you know, to bring about that access, not only when it comes to the medication side, but we also want to expand into being the township logistics companies to connect people from townships and to other big companies which are situated in the CBD. And I'm a beneficiary of the SAB Foundation. I still currently receive mentoring programs through the SAB Foundation. So there's a mentor that makes sure that every week, thrice a week, it's there to assess my business, to see what are the challenges, where am I lacking, where can we improve, what help can SAB Foundation bring on. So it's been a very close journey, and it's been a very, very wonderful and interesting but also difficult journey, but it's part of being an entrepreneur. You learn every day, and yeah, that's just what I do. But my goal is to just replicate the model every township. I mean, I've received calls in Soweto 2 weeks ago. There was an article in the Sunday Times, people asking me about the move to Soweto. So I'm working on those, you know, people from Eastern Cape calling us when we were on shift on ECB shift one, people calling us wanting such services. And initially, that's my goal, just to grow this model and make sure that people, go to hospitals, get the medication, don't wait for 3 to 4 hours just to get a packet of medication. Thank you.
So what is the impact on this gender system? What is the impact on the sex legislation?
One thing I forgot, a big recognition. I was listed on Forbes' most 30 under 30, most promising entrepreneurs around Africa. I'm sitting top on promising. So it's a very good recognition.
Thanks. I never get tired of hearing Seedway's story. So in terms of the small business funding entity, there are just some parts of the legislation that we just wanted to bring to your attention, some of just our concerns over the way it's currently written. The first one is that in the legislation it says a small funding entity is required to make funding widely accessible to all small, medium, and micro-sized enterprises. And essentially all we're saying here is that we have a selection process to make sure that, it is actually a real business. And so I think anyone who is making these kinds of funds available would not want it to be available to everybody, because there is a selection, and in our case it is a BEE foundation. So all of our beneficiaries need to be black individuals. So we were just thinking that maybe you could put some criteria in there, or maybe a note as a guide, just to put a few additions into that. Then the second concern we had is, well, it's not a concern, it's just not clear, is that it says that the small business funding entity is required to distribute at least 25% of amounts received or accrued in any tax year. And so what is not clear is it in the current tax year, the amount accrued in the current tax year, or in any year? Because if it's in any year, the concern that we have is that obviously our foundation and any other foundation that has this mandate has a capital amount that has been invested, and that allows us, the dividends are what we use, and that allows us to operate in perpetuity. So we wouldn't even have it, we wouldn't have an issue if you up that to 50% of the amount accrued in the current tax year. But the challenge for us and for anyone else is that you don't want to eat into that capital amount. And at the moment, this legislation is not totally clear. And so it's just a wording issue. So I just want, we just wanted to draw that to your attention. And then there is a restriction that says a small funding entity cannot have shares or other interests in any business connected to persons who are part of the committee or board of management of the small funding entity. And obviously we can completely understand why this was put in. The challenge that we have, though, is that SA Breweries Limited has a share scheme for, as part of their BEE transaction for black individuals that work in the company. It is a very small portion of SAB Limited shares. It's less than 1%. But we have two trustees that are beneficiaries of that scheme that sit on the SAB Foundation board. So it's a challenge for us because obviously there is no conflict of interest for them. They are two of six trustees, and three of which are external to the company. But at the moment, it puts us in a difficult position under the current legislation. SAB Foundation has 1.5% of SAB Limited shares. So that was another issue that we had. And then there's the lack of passive income exemption. And this really relates to the interest that we accrue on the capital. On the dividends. And so, I'm sure you understand that, you know, in order for us to make responsible investments, there is sometimes a lag in terms of the money coming in and us disseminating those funds. So there is some interest that accrues on that money, and the interest we would like to be able to use to fund entrepreneurs. And there isn't that, you know, in the PBO legislation, there passive income such as interest is exempt. So we're just recommending that either all passive income, including capital gains, is exempt, or that you raise the 5% threshold to 10%, because at the moment it's 5%, or provide a special exemption for interest earned from bank deposits. And again, this is the case with anybody, any foundation that is accruing dividend income that is investing in grassroots and startup entrepreneurs. And then there is a situation which is fairly unique to SAB, and that is that in 2020, SAB Limited shares will be converted into SAB Miller PLC shares. At the moment, SAB Limited is not a listed company in South Africa. SAB Miller PLC is listed in South Africa. And so with that share swap that's going to happen in 2020, we will be liable for capital gains under the current legislation. And there is no capital gains exemption, so which means that, again, we will have to pay a significant portion of our capital. Now, the capital amount is the amount, obviously, as I previously mentioned, that we'll be able to fund through dividend income entrepreneurs in perpetuity. So if we, what will happen in 2020 is we will have to use that capital amount to pay tax, then means that the capital amount in perpetuity will be a lot smaller for us to get dividend income on and to be able to put into entrepreneurs. So the recommendation is that we either provide a capital gains tax exemption that matches the same legislation for PBOs, or extend the tax relief for share transactions, Section 42. To cover the small funding entities, even if the shares are foreign, as in this case. So that's really all we have to say. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Members, what we'll do is take questions on these three, and then if there's space, Tandy wants to raise some question, and we can come back to that. Okay, over to you.
I'll be interested in getting the response from Treasury and SARS, what the implication of this presentation by SA Breweries is, looking at the fact that Eskom has Eskom Foundation, MTN Foundation, most of them, and all these foundations are aimed at empowering young people, entrepreneurs into those things, and what are the tax implications on all these things. So this exercise, they may not be here, and of course they'll be caught off guard or whatever in their small corners, but this legislation has its own unintended consequences on what we will be taxing on monies that they thought they should put sort of ring fence for entrepreneurs and other related things. And I'm sure your response to this or how you're going to mitigate on this thing will be very interesting. That's the first thing. The second thing, Chair, I think I was right yesterday in my mind when I said I hear what AgriSA is saying, but if they were presenting with other farming structures, then it would give us a better picture. Even seated here, AFASA is, and please pardon me for my ignorance, it's a completely new structure to me. There's, in Limpopo, there's, and I speak for Limpopo, there's a black farmers emerging campaign, Black Farmers Union. I don't know what they call it, but I just hope whether these are a conglomeration of that or they are a sector within that. But the presentation that they made, in as far as the challenges and the far-reaching implication of what this tax law amendment bill is about, also bring unintended consequences. And they have also touched on a number of things. So it will be very important, and this is an appeal I'm making to National Treasury. It will be very important that these critical stakeholders that are similar in terms of, say, we target all the farming, farmers, you know, organizations, and then sit with them and look at some of this, because the important thing, you know, the president pronounces on rural development, he pronounces on food security, he pronounces on all those things on behalf of the ruling party. But as government, we then bring other things that not necessarily shoot down on this, but their impact unintendedly bring other things that may undermine some of the intended activities. So how we balance the act and look at, you know, not making people to be worse off, because we want a bigger entry into the agricultural sector by previously disadvantaged people, and especially because among them there are many land claimants, including me, and most of them, their land claims are prime. Their land claims are prime agricultural areas or tourism or other related things. So how you deal with these matters will be very, very critical. The last issue, Chair, is the presentation by bargaining council. There's a slide that confused me, and I'm not sure that if the bargaining council, and this slide, Chair, speaks directly to some of the things that we spoke on. The bargaining council says we want exemption, and it's a presentation by a number of them, but if you look at what they are doing, there's a slide, it's only that they are not numbered. The slide says, it is important to know that one of the powers of a bargaining council in terms of Section 28(1)(g) of the Labor Relations Act is that it can establish, administer, and administer pension, provident fund, medical aid. over and above what you spoke about. Now, once you play into the financial services sector, why do you want to be treated somehow? Because there are those people who are in the same area as you in the pension fund scheme, in the provident fund scheme, and if you want to be exempted, then it means every other person should be exempt, unless if you're saying you are drawing our attention to the holiday, whatever. But this whole paragraph confuses me and then says to me, you have to be treated like other people who are with you because of the space you play in. Thank you, Chair.
There are two. I want to raise 2 points here. One is in relation with the presentation by Afasa. The other one would be in relation to SAP. With Afasa, well, their presentation is straight and forward. They are making a business case here of why should the zero rating be retained. And a contrast that is made between their presentation and that of AgriSA. Confirms what yesterday I referred to as a relationship based on love and hate. More than 2 million black families depend on communal farming system. More than 2 million and about 330,000 commercial, mainly white farmers. This is a stark reflection of the need for people to be taken back to land. And we are making a fuss about land restitution and all of that. One historical injustice which will take a generation to overcome and to address. I'm getting to the relevance. That these families will have to be taken back to land. The historical injustice which has been visited upon them, that a black person has been uprooted from his land, his wealth, and his family.
Leave it to you. The point is, what's the relevance of what you're saying to the tax proposals they're making on exemption, on the VAT being retained? The zero rating, at least.
Well, I think if you can be patient, Honorable Chair. Otherwise, would simply be here to romanticize about issues.
Same with even ANC members. We have to be precise.
And
what
political statements have been made.
But I mean, we agree. Now, what's the point?
Okay, let me leave that point. But it's the bottom line here is that their submission in relation to the retention of the zero rating, so far as emerging and black farmers are concerned, it's a compelling case. Two, on the SA, I want to check if SAB, and I want to understand the intermediary companies. Are they locally based? Are they abroad in the so-called tax havens, where transfer pricing, base erosion, and profit shifting through that practice and the system, a lot of revenue is generated, which should be directed to the gentlemen like yourself, and the initiative that they're taking should be benefiting them. Where are these intermediary companies located?
I'm sorry, I'm not an expert on this. I work for the foundation. Pardon?
You haven't been asked to answer yet.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm teasing you. Don't get that defensive. You know, it's very boring chairing here. I must tell you. If I don't say anything, I'll fall asleep.
Shepherdson, thank you. I think Pinky has covered me on the bargaining council. But I just want to emphasize that the clause that they are quoting on the Labor Relations Act, it says care. It's a choice that they had, and they have made that. And also saying that one understand that the information that they're giving us, we should know they are responsible for. It's for them to motivate, which at some stage I ask myself, why do they give us this information? Because, of course, members within that sector have to contribute for them to have the bargaining council. So what's the relevance? But now I understand they were just telling us we have these responsibilities, then we have to sympathize with them. I also want to ask AFASA if they've given us the number of, different categories, category A, B, and C. In terms of the membership, where do they recruit? All three categories or specific categories? Thank you, Chair.
To clarify something that I've asked previous presenters, I think it was quite short to ask you, with regard to the 40%, 40% subsidy for smallholder farmers that you're now proposing. I made the point that I think that their cost is escalated by about 14% because they're not registered and they can't claim it back. And I think they then said no, they will still be in the same position. Of course they will be in the same position, but they are in a prejudiced position that they are paying 40% more because they're not registered. And I think this is a massive challenge to get them registered. You can have a zero rating. So do you agree with me that we should really work towards that? And because of the cost of farming, and it's so expensive and the very small margins in terms of profit and the high risk of this industry, I think it's just imperative that we look at this 14%, either a subsidy or the other challenge of getting them registered. I'd just like to have your views. Thank you.
I'm partially covered by the previous speaker. I think the most important thing here is that as much as possible, we also would like to be encouraging compliance, because it's very difficult to take a decision. We are considering a tax amendment bill here, and if we are going to be premising our arguments on people that are not even registered, it's going to be very difficult. So I think it's good, and I don't want us to be playing AgriSA against AFASA. I think both of them, they have a role to play, because we do need commercial farmers. I don't care who says what. We do need those massive farmers who can export and so forth. So I'm saying we need to be cautious about that. But also I wanted to hear from probably AFASA to tell us whether is there any relationship that they have established with SARS maybe to try and assist the small farmers so that they are compliant, because if they are compliant, even when they are making recommendations like this, it's easier when you are dealing with empirical evidence. Now, we don't know whether these figures you are giving us are dumb fact, because we have no record, because they're not there. Thank you.
You want to reply to the issues for two?
Thank you, Chair. Most of the bargaining councils don't necessarily have pension funds because
of what happened in terms of the Pension Fund Act and the Medical Aid Scheme Act, which became very disruptive at that point in time, because bargaining council for a long time, for years, this bargaining council is 62 years old. For a long time, bargaining councils were handling everything, but with the new legislation that came into place, like the Pension Fund Act, all those things that became a bit disruptive to bargaining councils. And also, you remember, most of the bargaining councils, you've got smaller employers. So it means then you are then creating a lot of work for bargaining councils. It means a bargaining council must deal with the pension fund, it must deal with the bargaining council, it must deal with a whole range of issues, skills development issues, a whole range of payments and things that they need to do. That creates a bureaucracy for an employer that is the only employer employing only five employees. So those are sort of issues. But our focus mainly is the issue on administration services. That even if, for example, you are taking away those two issues that I've mentioned to you, which is the medical aid, which you have got legislation and of which we have complied. We're no longer managing pension funds. We're no longer managing most of the bargaining councils. I'm no longer managing. But what is happening, you still have got the leave pay. You still have got sick and maternity funds that you have. You've got all these things that you've had for a number of years, which therefore assist in terms of peace and stability in the industry, and also taking away the burden from the employer from discussing all these issues amongst themselves and dealing with them as a bargaining council, we can deal with it. But in some cases, you find that bargaining councils still collect monies on behalf of the pension fund because it makes things easier. Because what you do is that if you're creating a situation where a pension fund must then go after the employer that is not paying the pension. Just to share with you, at the moment we are owed almost R500 million of employers not paying over pension fund monies that are not paying it over to it's pension fund monies of people. And most of these people, that's the only money that they have when they either passes away or they go into retirement. Bargaining councils still have the people that needs to do the compliance. So what you do is that you then have a bargaining council on one side and have a pension fund on one side. But if you have the collection process done by a bargaining council, paying it over to a pension fund, at least you've got a one-stop shop, and you know that the employer deals with one person and it doesn't have to deal with hundreds and hundreds of different organizations in terms of those payments. I think that's where our main issue is.
Thank you for the questions and comments. I'll start with who we are. We are a national association. We came into existence in 2011, and I think you know the works of unions. You have a number of them because it's a voluntary association. So, yes, there are a few around, but we're also a national association representing smallholder farmers. And we're not in competition with the other unions, really. We work closely together. We've got what we call the Agri-Sector Unity Forum, and in there sits AFASA, Agri-SA, DAO-SA, and NAFU. So we all sit together and we discuss the issues of common interest, but each one of us remains independent to talk about our sector. So I wouldn't say there's actually any conflict at all. I mean, the Agri-SA will talk on behalf of the commercial sector, but we will always talk on behalf of the smallholder farmers who are your predominantly, most of them are on communal land. A lot of them already had farms from your former homelands. They bought them, leased them, and they're still there. And then a number of them are coming in through the land reform process. So those are our members that we represent. Then the issue of the 14% subsidy. We have talked about the possibility of registration, but I think it's going to be very difficult because you won't be able to get everyone. You'll probably be able to get those that do understand issues and can actually get their names on a database.
But your very smallholder farmer in some village, they might find the whole process very difficult to go through. And I think that's partly why they're not registered. The process tends to be too cumbersome. I think you register and you must do your submissions every month or every 2 months. It becomes too cumbersome, administratively cumbersome for most of them. I mean, you must know most of the farmers that we represent don't even keep financial records of their own business, never mind trying to register the business and get a VAT number on that. So that's why we are proposing the subsidy. But I think the essence is some concession must be there for them. The nitty-gritties can be looked into. And then relationship with SARS, I've already indicated the farmers are not registered with SARS, and most of them don't really understand that whole process. And we haven't had much interaction as an association with SARS, but it's certainly going to come up. It's one of the issues that we'll be discussing in our Congress in October. We've actually invited SARS to talk to farmers about compliance in general. What do they need to comply with and what does it take? So it's one of those learning processes that we are still going through. I think that covers everything, Manish. The members have addressed that it's national. It's basically your smallholder farmers, predominantly on communal land, and those with smaller holdings on private land, whether leased or owned.
The 14% subsidy is not an issue I think this committee can consider. It's something you need to raise with the Ministry of Land, Agriculture, and the committee and so on. But that's not something that falls within. Would I be correct with this? Okay, but the other aspects we obviously are able to respond to. Okay, over to you, SAB.
Mr. Chair, I think it was just the one question about intermediary companies. Just to say that you know, SAB Miller is a global company. In fact, it's the second biggest brewer in the world by volume. And the intermediary companies are a number of different registered entities around the world, of one of which is SAB South Africa.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, can we have National Treasury's response and then SARS? And then the internal meeting for 3-4 minutes, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. My response is do the SAB and the Bargaining Council SARS will deal with the VAT issue on repeal of zero rating. With regard to SAB Foundation, the tax implications are as follows. This year we've made amendments so that both SAB Foundation and IESA can benefit in the tax system. So what we've made is that when CISA receives 100,000 from SAB, that money will be tax-free on CISA's hands. So when SAB build up the money so that he can give it to CISA, that money is also tax-free in SAB's hands. So both these entities will be exempt from tax. So now what SAB has raised regarding the issue of oil, those are the clarity on language issues that we'll need to discuss with them and take them out if they hinder the intention of the legislature. Secondly, with the bargaining council, we thought by making these amendments in the legislation, we are giving them the exemption that they always wanted. So if these amendments are not reaching the intent, we'll discuss with them and then we'll clarify the issues and then we'll make the necessary changes so that those amendments reach the policy intent. I'll give over to SARS to deal with the VAT and the repeal of rent.
Thanks, Chair. We've seen a common theme coming from the commentators on the zero rating. I think we, in order to develop a medium-term solution, we need to go back to our compliance efforts and see what we may have to do between short and medium term to get the industry to know what compliance should entail. There may be some consequential amendments on upfronting what the changes would be. Having said that, maybe, and I've mentioned this yesterday, we should really go full circle to close the loop on the full impact. The full impact, you know, today we heard AFASA estimates commercial sector to be 30,000. Yesterday's Agri SA says there's 40,000. We have on record 70,000 farmers registered with this dispensation. Yes. So in order to give effect to the findings that come out for the purposes of determining the impact on food security, increasing cost,
loss in production, and those type of things. We need to put some numbers, because in the future we can make reference to those numbers and establish that we've done it in a scientific way, and that we've taken the correct policy position. I will certainly, as part of our development of formal responses, communicate to my principals that we need to take a harder look at some of the compliance issues. See, before you get to enforcement, you need to have an understanding of the ABCs of compliance by the taxpayer. And that's not in place. All it is a certificate out there that says, please supply me at the zero rate. There's nothing more that needs to be done. Some of the comments mentioned about, you know, having extra capturing points on the return, that will accompany with it administrative costs, which may or may not, and in my experience, where you have a capturing point on a tax return that does not influence your liability for tax, because it was just an information source, there will inherently be lower levels of compliance. But we need to balance and see what the industry can do. But I think the comments that were made so far.
Before we round up, one is that, look, firstly, we are not tax experts, we are politicians. The same applies in the United States or Sweden or wherever. Right? There are people here who have got technical expertise in the area because of other roles they play. We have got limited research capacity. The Parliamentary Budget Office is assisting us, but neither of the two young men there are experts in tax. So we think, unlike other bills that appear before our committee, here, and I'm pleading with National Treasury and SARS, we would like to see as much consensus as possible evolve based on these hearings over the next few weeks. So when you come back to us with your final responses, at the very least, we're going to be very demanding of you to show us that you have engaged with the public stakeholders. Because the quality of some of their submissions, based from the point of view of politicians, remember, we're not technical experts, seem very credible, seem very reasonable to us. And you've had very limited time to respond. No doubt when you come back to us in 3 weeks, when we listen to you more carefully, we will then say, oh no, you're right. But the unfortunate thing about this process is they will not be here to respond to what you're saying. So we would like you to take very, very seriously the submissions made over the last 6 hours, yesterday and today. And we will be really inquiring about how seriously you've taken them, which is not to say you have to agree with it, to say, look, we've thought about it, these are the 5 reasons why we said no. That's what we're pleading for. This is not the municipal systems bill, as I like say. That's political. We don't need officials. We will decide those things. Really. We don't even need the officials here. Those things we can deal with. Here, you have to, the implications of what we're doing on the fiscus and a whole lot of other things on the economy are too huge to expect a team of politicians, whether in the U.S. or here, to be able to manage with our limited research capacity. Secondly, what we are saying is that there are 3 major areas that seem to emerge a lot. The effect on the small business, the farmers, particularly are considered emerging farmers, and 23M with all its complexities. Okay? Then there are issues that are very simple to deal with. People are saying you're not clear in your drafting. Those things you can deal with. And that ultimately is something we can do something about. That is Parliament's responsibility. The policy issues are complex, but once we're clear about them, that's our job. And we should bring in some expertise as well to assist us in these bills. Other bills we can manage ourselves. So what we're pleading for is for no genuflection. In other words, don't come here and tell us, yeah, you'll take it seriously, and then, as often happens with the executive, it's not taken seriously. Also, I want to alert stakeholders here. We see through many of the things you do. We're not naive 21 years later. But what we do know is that if we were in your position, we'd probably say the same thing. Okay? So, you know, and if you were in my position here as a chair, you'd say the same thing. So really, we see through you. Nobody wants to pay tax anywhere in the world. We've never come across a democracy where somebody says, ah, yes, I'm prepared to pay tax. That would be an insane democracy, okay? So we see through some of the things. Your policy submissions and so on, some of it, even though I know nothing very much about tax, I can see through it, really, because I'm guided by my instinct and what I know about human beings in general. Okay, so let me say finally that The members, I want to thank you very much for the quality of what the members, can you give me a moment, please, don't heckle. These people normally do that. The quality, no, it was a joke, Sam, it was a joke.
See, the modern agency heckles at us. The modern, which class they represent.
Have a system, you guys.
Shall we please avoid
sideshows,
please?
Look, we as a committee need to apply our minds for next year. Some issues that I think, doesn't matter who's chairing here next year, you never know in politics, I might be in Mongolia, but the things that emerge are, one is this is a special year, National Treasury. We were less rigorous, A, because we're a relatively new committee, B, because of the election year, right? So what we are saying is, next year, you must be very demanding. The gap between the time we advertise for the public hearing and the time we have the public hearing, let's be wider. We must have their submissions on time. Now, they give us long stuff. You can't expect a British politician, let alone South Africans, one to read it, right? So we want your slide presentations. It must be available by the Thursday morning before the week of the hearing so that members can read. Okay? We're on the plane. And so on and so on, and we're sitting in boring meetings over weekend, we can read, right? So we need to be more equipped to manage these things. So these are some suggestions I've got, right? Now, Dion, what more profound things can you say than what I've just said? Let's hear.
This is a very exciting committee. I don't like you talking about boring orders. Now, this is
I'm going to say. Okay, Dion.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have agreed with most of what you said. I wanted to add to something that SARS had said about the retirement tax. Now, we were told by SARS that there had been, or there would be, I wasn't in the committee last year, but that committee was told that there was going to be engagement with the industry because there's a huge retirement reform process underway. But there have been changes to the tax laws, and now there are unintended consequences and major problems in them. And SARS told us earlier that there would be consultation with the industry. There doesn't seem to have been any. Now a year has come past, and now we've got a new set of tax laws, and the changes are to be effected from the 1st of March 2015 with very serious problems. So what I want to know when they come back to this committee is what engagement has there been, and why is this being rolled out on the 1st of March, given all the problems that they've got? I think they should be delayed for another year so that they can be properly looked at. So I would be looking very much for that when they come back. Thank you, Chair.
Not to get so angry about it, but yeah, good, okay, we agree.
You know, Chair, I agree fully with all of what you have said, but just add one important message to AFASA. That we, in as much as they want to plead poverty and say we are previously disadvantaged, they should also get their house in order and make sure that anybody who is an African farmer that they think must benefit out of this thing must get organized accordingly. So that, because the more you are disorganized, the more you lose on other opportunities. Your farmers, you were saying here that some of them don't have records. So the more you empower them on small basic issues, the more you will make them to benefit on all other things. And you must say this is the message from the chairperson of the committee, Comrade Yunis Karim. It's saying get organized and do the right thing.
All right. Having said that, let me finally say that, Mr. Ndima, you've been an inspiration. At 22, an inspiration. I wish you and the South African SAB Foundation and you're doing very good work at SAB. I hope this is not the only person that's like that. I gather from what you're saying there. Obviously, you spin. You're just like politicians, right? Yeah, they spin. But even, yeah. Right. Now, look, Mr. Ndima. We want to congratulate you and the South African Brewery Foundation, but we also want you to inspire others.
as you said. And we like your enthusiasm. So you've been an enormous inspiration to us, and we wish you well and the foundation. Now, can you please all leave promptly, because we want to break into a fight here.
Bring it on.